6, we'll get started. Welcome to Justice and Public Safety today, and we're going to name the Sergeant-at-Arms. House Sergeant-at-Arms are Bob Rossi and Doug Harris, and the Sergeant-at-Arms in the Senate, Anderson Meadows and Billy Pritcher. Thank you all for serving today. We're going to get started. I wanted to see if you want to say anything that you've welcomed everybody.
I'd like to welcome everybody here today. I also like to give a kudos to DPS. As I was riding up here today, I was listening to the radio about the case of the kidnapping of this past week of the Wake Forest guy. And I know that there was not a lot of information given over the radio, but I just like to give kudos to the state agencies that were involved and how professional everybody was. And according to the radio, that it really could not have happened without the crime lab, the SBI, DOC. And if you haven't heard about it, I encourage you to read up on it, because it's real interesting. And also it makes you proud to be part of this committee. But I'd also like to give kudos that to me, why this committee is important and JPS is important, because that's our first, to me, constitutional responsibility to the citizen is for protection and justice and public safety. So I would like to say to those that are listening and those that are in the audience, I am very proud to be part of you guys, and I would just like to say thank you.
And I certainly concur with that, and we are proud to serve on this committee and to help our citizens in justice and public safety. Senator Goolsbee is not here today. He had a trial he had to be at, and we'll miss him. And we lost a member, Senator Claude Felter, who is now the mayor of Charlotte. We will miss him on this committee, but we wish him well in his new position. Has everyone read the minutes? And if so, I do need a... So moved. Okay. Senator Randleman moved. Is there a second? Okay. All in favor say aye. Thank you. Okay. First, we'll have our staff to go over the follow-up questions from our March meeting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Fox with the Fiscal Research Division. The first question was to provide a copy of the list of vehicles that were purchased by DOA for DPS. That is your first attachment. The second question was whether the Department of Administration negotiates extended warranties with manufacturers, and they have not to date. They're discussing whether or not they will do that in the future. The third question was actually a series of questions about court reporters and their equipment. What kind of equipment is required, how much it costs, what the maintenance and replacement costs are, and then a second question that I broke out, which is what it would cost to wire courtrooms for digital voice recording. So since we've just been talking about cars a little bit, court reporter equipment is a lot like cars in that there are a number of options and packages. So you can buy the Escort of recording equipment, or you can buy a Cadillac of recording equipment. So you'll see here that there are some estimates provided for different levels of equipment and different options, wired or wireless connections, increase or decrease the cost. And then similarly, there are also maintenance packages that court reporters can buy that provide a sort of insurance and ongoing maintenance. And they can choose to do either deluxe maintenance that provides for replacement costs, or they can do a sort of basic package that's a la carte. So they also have to do updates for their software equipment. You'll see that on the top of page 2. The follow-up question about whether AOC has an estimate for cost to wire courtrooms for digital voice recording, they do not have an estimate for this. And the fourth question is that the administrative office of the courts notes that there were $313,000 in implementation costs for the new credit card pilot program. And attachment B details those costs and what those funds were spent on. Question 5 is whether collection rates increased with the implementation of credit card payments in courthouses. The AOC does not measure collection rates. And question 6 is how the administrative office of the courts is dealing with credit card chargebacks. AOC has not responded to this particular question. Question 7, how many cases do the Special Assistant United States Attorneys handle annually? This question was not directly answered, but attachments C and D do detail some of the types of cases handled by two SASAs in the previous year. And finally, an updated Division of Juvenile Justice organization chart. The Department of Public Safety is still working on this request.
Okay, do we have any questions on these that were brought back? On the AOC credit card things, I was thinking that they contracted with this company that was guaranteed that they would take care of anything that came back. I may or may not be right on that, but that was my understanding. That was why they were getting all the fees from it, that they wouldn't have to deal with that. Is that correct? Is anyone here in the audience who knows? I'm sorry. Senator Bryant.
I was trying to read and keep up and catch up with you all as you were going through. I was concerned about AOC does not measure collection rates. I was curious how come, and it's interesting to me that either the state or we don't have some kind of audit requirements or something that will require some kind of record, you know, comparison of how much is owed, how much is collected, and how much, you know, something. That's just unusual. Can anybody add some insight to that? Or?
I think we have John Williams here from AOC.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Williams from AOC. With regard to the collection rates, we do not have an integrated financial package that integrates case records with financial records. So the cashier function at the courthouse records money as it comes in and then matches that up with the cases. When the judgment is entered in the courtroom, there are lots of different kinds of costs, including lab fees and things that aren't even available in the courtroom at the time a judgment may be passed out. And we don't have the capacity to integrate our late 1990s financial management system with current case management technology. That would be an entirely new technology package.
You know, one follow up.
All right.
Would there be any advantage in terms of our policy making as it relates to, you know, expenditures and receipts and what, and are we maximizing that? Would there be any advantage you could see to us looking at integrating those or some way to compare?
Yes, Senator
what
Bryant.
Is old, yeah.
John Williams, AOC. Yes, Senator Bryant, I agree it would be very good information for us to have. The clerk's offices take in about $775 million a year. Obviously, the various kinds of fines and fees and everything else imposed is greater than that. At this time, we are doing a sample-based audit to look at collection rates, but that is a manual process to identify a random list of cases statewide, go and pull those original cases, and then look at the financial records that follow so that we can begin to develop a baseline picture for collection. But again, that is a manual sample-based process.
Okay. One comment to you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Just to the committee and to the chairs, I don't know if I'm not understanding JPS. I don't know if this has been something that's been considered ongoing, but I know in the budgeting process every year, there's a whole lot of these JPS fees that we rely on for budgeting purposes, and now I'm hearing we don't even know how well we're doing or what the track record is or something. I'm wondering if it would be worth at least staff advising us, is there a way we can look at that? The cost, is there a way to incrementally move forward or something?
We have been discussing this, and there's so many different things in play. Okay, Representative Boss.
And I would like to add with
Senator Bryant, is that we don't know how much the judges are still dismissing charges, which was mandated in legislation.
Okay, I got you. Mr. Williams.
Senator Bryant, John Williams again, AOC. Part of the complication in the court system is typically a sentence will say, you're sentenced to 30 days, that judgment is suspended upon payment of whatever. In many cases, defendants choose to serve active time. So until the defendant chooses whether they want to serve the active time and accept the suspended sentence for payment, I mean, this is not a normal accounting problem, I guess, to say that you can satisfy a money judgment by serving active time in the jail. So it's not quite like other kinds of financial processes.
And while you're there, Mr. Williams, getting back to the credit card situation, is that correct that you contracted with someone and they get all the fees? Is that correct?
They get the fees for administering the credit card equipment and transactions. And we have put together information that I thought was forwarded to the committee about the contractual terms for chargebacks, but there are very few chargebacks, and the first line of negotiating chargebacks is with the vendor.
Okay, because I thought that any bad checks or anything like that would be back to, well, that wouldn't be through the credit thing. So
that's right, and if a chargeback is made, and then that has to come back upstream to remove the credit for payment from the judgment, et cetera, but that chargeback process is part of the, what we contract for.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on this section? Okay. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman. I'd like to ask a follow-up question on the credit cards. I'm looking at Attachment B, which if I'm reading through the answers here, kind of seem to have a breakdown of the cost. And would Mr. Williams be the right person to answer this? I'm not sure. My question would be, I'm trying to understand what some of these line items are and why they're necessary. For example, the whole disk encryption for laptops. What is involved with laptops on credit card transactions that would require encryption and that kind of cost, for example?
Mr. Williams.
John Williams from AOC. Senator Newton, the whole disk encryption, that probably is an area that may not be required strictly for the credit card transactions at the cashier's desk, but that is an overall security issue with the entire organization. And when you're doing the compliance, it's called PCI compliance for handling credit cards, they look at your entire security operation. So that's how that subject came to the fore in looking at implementing credit cards.
All right.
Thank you, sir. So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that the vendor that we're contracting with is, in addition to their getting the contract rate of payment, the dollar per transaction and the percentage, they have certain mandates on us for equipment and security, and so you've got to make upgrades in order to comply with their systems. Is that the gist of it?
Yep, Senator John Williams and AOC. It's not just this vendor, it's every credit card vendor. The PCI compliance standard is a national standard from financial institutions that process the credit card transaction. So it applies to Target, it applies to Sears, it applies to everyone who has enterprise-wide financial integration with the credit card system.
Thank you. I'll follow up offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Newton. Anyone else have any questions on this part? Okay, thank you, Lisa. All right, we will go to the presentation of the Juvenile Justice Strategic Facilities Plan. Deputy Commissioner of Administration for Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice, Joe Prater.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Joe Prater. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice with Department of Public Safety. On behalf of Secretary Perry, Commissioner Geis, and the leadership in Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice, would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to come before you today to provide you with this plan that we have regarding the future of juvenile justice in North Carolina. I should go ahead and tell you that we have 22 slides here. I promise you I'll go through it quickly. Commissioner Geis has threatened me already that if I get too long, he's going to take a hook and pull me off the stage, so I hope that we won't get to that point. Of the 22 slides, I've got the majority of those. Mr. Laster has several of them, and Commissioner Geis has one. So I think you know why that is. I will tell you, we've come from a banquet for volunteers of our prisons operation, and it was very inspiring. So I'll go ahead and forewarn you that he's inspired today from that as well. Regarding the presentation overview itself, these are the items that we'd like to go over with you and touch on today. We've got some directives that put us here today. We have some objectives. We want to go over the process that was followed in development of this plan, because I want you to understand that process was very significant. Those who were involved with it's very significant as well. And we'll go over those details, and we need to address the long-term plans in this juvenile justice strategic plan as well, and we'll recap that. So what brings us here today are two directives. But on this slide, there are actually two critical points that I'd like to make to you that will prevail throughout the entire presentation. First of all, in the committee, in the committee's October 10th, 2014 meeting, as directed, Commissioner Geis presented renovation costs and plans for the kitchen at Dobbs Youth Development Center. At that time, we asked for, and you were gracious enough to allow us to go back and look at the big picture, and that's why we're here today. We wanted to look at the broader perspective and where the juvenile justice system needs to be going. Secondly, and this is very important, General Statute 143B-806B actually mandates that the Secretary do certain things in the area of juvenile justice. It's important to note that most of this involves youth development centers, and I'd like to try to remember that throughout as well. A lot of what we'll be talking about involves youth development centers and changes. In addition to that, I'd like for you to understand that there's a significant amount that has to do with being able to transfer funds. Specifically, in these general statutes, Secretary is mandated to work on making changes to youth development centers, and specifically that he phased out as populations diminish. And what you'll learn and see, and what you may already be aware of, is that national trends are moving in that direction, that populations of commitments in youth development centers are in fact diminishing, and they are in this state as well. So that is a directive that is very much in play. Secondly, and this is very important, close a state youth development center when its operation is no longer justified, and this is very significant, and transfer state funds appropriated to that youth development center to fund other things. And specifically, what we're looking at is funding community-based programs. We're also looking at purchasing of services in community-based and other appropriate operations, and to improve the efficiency of the operations of youth development centers. And this transfer of funds, of course, requires consultation with the Joint Legislative Commission on Government Ops. But what's very important to understand, this is a unique opportunity. This is a unique statute that allows the department to actually progressively, proactively, systematically transfer funds in the direction we need to be going as we go along. And you will see that this plan very much recommends that and is contingent on doing that. The other items relate to using the facilities appropriately, doing certain programs that are evidence-based practices. And there's another one listed down there that has to do with some HR changes that come into play as well. I want to touch on the mission. In looking at our mission, there are several objectives that are particularly relevant to this plan. It mentions reducing and preventing juvenile delinquency and effectively operating. These are key words. And looking at integrated, comprehensive juvenile justice systems, it does the things that are listed in that mission with intervention, education, and treatment of youth. And the bottom line, of course, is that we want to have public safety. But what's also in there, you'll notice, is working with families. And you'll find that there's a component of that in this strategic plan as well.
Excuse me, Deputy Commissioner Prater. I want to tell the committee to please hold your questions until all three of the speakers have spoken in this part. Write them down so that we can have it at the end of this session. The three talking. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. On the next slide, let's talk about the strategic plan itself a little bit. It's important to note before we begin getting into the details of the plan that it's actually more than a facilities plan. That's really the discussion that was had back in October. Come back with us about a facilities plan because it involved a facility. And what we wanted to do is take a look at the entire picture, the big picture, look at it comprehensively, not just about the facilities themselves. So what you're going to see today is what we describe as a comprehensive blueprint of the proposed operations of the juvenile justice system in North Carolina. I will tell you that at times the presentation is going to feel brick and mortarish, or it may feel very fiscal related, because that is important, in fact, but a lot of this is about the change in the direction, the right direction that we want to go that this plan does. So this is a comprehensive plan, and as such, we needed to have, and we used a broadly based, comprehensively represented group of leaders in our organization, in our agency, to put this plan together. To give you a sense of how broad that was, that included facilities, programs, treatment, education, juvenile court services, engineering, maintenance, our HR folks who were with us around the table, budget folks were with us. It was important to have input from all aspects of these operations. And I have to tell you, this team was very enthusiastic. They were very encouraged at the opportunity to make some changes. We were all in accord, and this was a very good operation of a collaboration. We have many of those folks here with us from the committee, and I would like to ask them to stand, if they would, please, so you can see who's here. We felt like they put so much into this report that we had them come and join us. Thank you all. I certainly appreciate that.
Thank you for coming.
They worked hard, they dug in, and we worked on a lot of things. And so we had a broad expertise in putting this together. Okay. That slide also shows some of the things that are contained in the report. I'll let you look at that at maybe another time and not go into all the details of that. But I will say this, that we wanted to have, you'll find that the report itself, and it's about 32 pages in length, goes back and looks at history. Because, you know, as we've learned, history is very important in the direction we may be wanting to go. Secondly, it talks about the advances that have been made. And it also discussed the national trends, state trends, so that we can get a perspective on what this plan is intending to do. And then we go to where I often live, and that's the bottom line, the fiscal impact of this plan. And, of course, we need to take a look at the future as well. Okay. So one more thing I'd like to go over. This is very important to understand that the plan acknowledges the history, as we've said, but the next bullet here and those behind that I think are very important to this being a strategic plan. It actually invests and capitalizes on the previous state financial commitments. There are some things that the state has already appropriated funds for. Some things that are in the works, there are capital improvements that are underway, moving forward with those. This plan blends those already committed funds into where we're wanting to go. This plan also enhances operations by moving more towards safer and more secure facilities, and which are more cost efficient. The reinvestment part of this is something that you're very familiar with on the adult side, but what we're looking at here is taking, shifting the youth development center cost savings from that to the evidence-based practices, including community-based programs. I would take you back to that general statute and what it mandates. However, I will stress this to you. It is very important, and we made sure we were going to do this, and that is preserve the best practices that have been put in place in treatment and education, and we want to use these solid principles of programming. And as has been stated before, it plans for the future as well. Here's the lay of the land of the facilities in North Carolina for juvenile justice. As you'll see, there are four youth development centers in North Carolina. They're listed below that. Six state detention centers, three county-owned and operated detention centers, five what are called multi-purpose juvenile homes, three level two residential programs, and two transition homes. Now, those last three items, community-based, Mr. Laster, when he comes up, he'll talk about those and he'll address those as well. But these are really the facilities that we currently have in play in North Carolina. Now, here's what the plan recommends. The plan recommends closing two youth development centers, those being C.A. Dillon and Dobbs. Also recommends to go along with that the reopening of two newer, more secure, recently funded closed youth development centers, those being Lenore and Edgecombe. In addition to that, we're looking at expanding two of those reopened new youth development centers and adding 12 additional youth development center beds. Meaning at Lenore and Edgecombe, we can take the facility within the footprint from 32 beds to 44, maintain the operations as they currently are. We'll take one existing, newer, more secure youth development center, that being Chatham Youth Development Center, and likewise adding 12 beds to that facility. They are basically the same footprint. They're prototypical of each other, and that's how we're able to do that. The remaining portion of renovated building at Stonewall Jackson Youth Development Center, McWhorter Building located there, we'd like to take what we call the other half of the bow tie. Phase one has already been funded, already been utilized. We'd like to take phase two and put that in the other part of what's called the McWhorter Building at Stonewall Jackson for 16 additional youth development beds. Then we get to the point where we'd like to take those funds that would be from those savings and reinvest those and use the existing appropriated funds to open 16 new, what are called crisis beds, open five new transitional homes totaling 40 beds, and to fund very critically needed expanded reentry services. And again, Mr. Laster will be getting into the details of how those function. Regarding detention centers, there are minor changes to those, no significant changes to detention centers. We are looking at a relocation of Gaston Detention Center to the Kirk Building at Stonewall Jackson Youth Development Center. That's a project that's already been funded, is already in the works. So that's, in essence, the change to the detention centers would be the movement of Gaston to that Kirk Building. And we're looking at some additional staff at youth development centers. Hope that doesn't mean my time is up, Maddie. That's Commissioner Geist doing that. The plan also recommends, back to that recurring theme a little bit, to complete the investments that the state has put in on some of these improvements and to try to go more toward what we call multi-use facilities. It is possible to combine detention centers and youth development centers. They don't necessarily have to be separate facilities. We can find more cost-efficient ways of running those, improving on the cost delivery to those facilities. And some of those things that are involved are renovations to the McWhorter Building, Phase 1, I previously mentioned that, renovations to the Kirk Building, we talked about that. Now, we'd also like to do renovations to what's called the D Housing Unit at Dillon Youth Development Center. That's a unit that's there that's already been funded for renovations. And so although we're closing Dillon, that particular building lays out very well and sets up well for crisis center beds. So it's using an investment that's already in place. It's using the dollars that are already, you know, going to that building and the renovations and saying, let's put some crisis beds there. And finally, we're looking at renovations to the closed Buncombe Detention Center to convert that to what's called a multi-purpose home. We asked Office of State Budget and Management for authority to take the capital funds that were previously allocated for the detention center at Buncombe that was subsequently closed. We asked them that we be able to take that money, capital money, and use that to renovate Buncombe Detention Center to a multi-purpose home. Now, also funded in this year's budget is the operating cost of what's called a Western multi-purpose home. So the operating funds are there. We've managed to go get the capital funds that were originally for the Buncombe Detention Center to make that a multi-purpose home. So those costs are none because the funding's already there for that facility. We'd also like to reclassify some identified positions to create a career path. These are some things that we'll look at going down the road, enhance detention center operations with some additional direct care staff, and study the current youth transportation system. This is something that we could not have ready at this time in the report, something that requires extensive study on how those transportation operations are occurring. Those are the transportation that would come from court, the detention centers, between facilities, those kinds of things that we feel like we need to take a closer look at. The plan that we have before you, we're anticipating, will take a year and a half to implement, beginning in November 2014 and concluding in July 2016. Here's the net result of this. The overall reduction of Youth Development Center bed capacity by one. So essentially, the YDC capacity remains about the same, increases the detention center bed capacity by eight. It also increases community-based programs capacity, crisis and transition beds, by 56. And it adds reentry services for an additional 150 youth and families. So we have an increase in multi-purpose home bed capacity by eight. We're moving in that direction of community-based item. And that one is the Buncombe facility I was mentioning. There is a reduction of 41 youth development center positions in the plan. And there is, last but not least, a net reduction of the annual operating costs of more than $690,000 after this is all said and done. Let me tell you that in the report, at the end of the report, there's, I believe on page 32, or could be on page 32, is kind of a scorecard. This is the large report, full-size report. There's a chart in that shows all of these changes, and as you move down, you can see the net reductions that we gained from this in doing the plan. Let me also explain what net means. As we move through the changes, the closures, the opening, the shifting, by the time you move down to the $690,000, those transfers have already occurred. In other words, where the closures occur and we want to move that to others, all of those work out as we move down. And after that is all completed, in other words, the transfers are already internal to this, then you have the $690,000 left over at the end of that. And after you go back and look at it, we've got a staff of reduction of 41 for youth development centers. What we would like to be able to do is take the $690,000 that we're estimating and be able to utilize that for those detention centers where we feel we need some additional staff, and there may be some of that funding we'd like to use for transportation enhancement. So to the bottom line, fiscally, the strategic plan actually funds no new costs for capital improvements. There are no costs for capital improvements for this. The key here is that we'd like to use the $1.7 million that we were before you in October about using for the Dobbs Kitchen to do the capital improvements that we're talking about in this plan. We want to take that $1.7 million and not necessarily use it for the kitchen, but we've got a plan for all the capital improvements that our engineering folks have put together to do some of these things, such as the expansion of the footprint of Lenoir, Edgecombe, and Chatham would be handled through these funds, no additional new funds, the previous $1.7 million. Fund no startup costs for the reopening of some of, these facilities, because we've closed facilities. We have existing facilities. We are going to be closing facilities, and what we're saying is we're not going to request additional equipment or furniture, but we're going to use those resources from within. Fund no new operating costs, because the reopening of facilities, remember the general statute 143-806, we don't need new funds to support the operating costs, because those are done through the transfer of the funds from the closed facilities. No new costs to support the operation of the crisis beds, because we've got flexibility with the funding of community-based programs that we can use toward that. No cost to that. Fund no new positions in this plan. Again, because of the transfers that we're looking at, we take the funds of the closed facilities and positions related to those that are allocated to those, and we move those funds over, and we actually create positions at the new facilities from those funds. And again, as I said earlier, try to utilize the funds left over to use for other items, including the detention centers and some transportation concerns. Since the general statute makes so much reference to the youth development centers, here's the way it looks. Here's how it lays out after said and done. You can see in this chart, you will see all the youth development centers that are in play there. And you can see, for example, where Jackson goes from 96 beds to 128, Chatham from the 32 to 44, Dobbs and Dillon showing the closures, Lenoir, Edgecombe showing the opening of 44 beds. And to the right, there's the change in the capacity. We're going from 261 beds total to 260. And then as you can see along the way, we go from 502 staff to 461. This next chart is just a layout of how this goes. It lists the youth development centers, detention centers, and what have you down the left side, and lists out the details of those. And when you go to the far right, you can see where you see the 41 position reduction. You see the 12 additional positions for detention centers. And you see the additional capacity in the middle part, where we're looking at 8 more beds for detention centers, 8 more for multi-purpose homes. We're looking at 40 for transition homes, 150 for the reentry programs. And again, Mr. Laster will go over some details of that. Ultimately, this is where we're trying to go. Did I mention GS 143-806? That's really what drives this. Again, it's about the direction that it wants us to go and the fact that it wants us to transfer funds to get there. And so where do we want to go? This graphic shows that. What we're looking at is a new emphasis on prevention, working with families, reentry, and some of the tools that are shown there at the bottom are the things that we want to try to implement. Again, through the use of the funds from closed youth development centers shifting over to these priorities. So this is really the direction that we're trying to go into, and that's really my cue to get out of the way so we can let others talk about this. But we're very excited about what this plan does and the things it attempts to achieve. I'll ask Mr. Laster if he'll come up and begin talking about where we're trying to go. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Billy Lassiter.
Good afternoon. Thank you, members, for inviting us to come and present this plan to you. Madam Chair, thank you for the time. If you can't get behind this plan, I don't know what you can't get behind, because this is, you just heard from Joe, basically you're getting all these new services, you're getting the new crisis beds, you're getting the transition home, you're only getting one less Wad EC bed, you're getting 8 new detention beds, I mean, and we're not asking you for more money. So how often do people come and present a plan like that to you guys? Probably very rarely. I just wanted to show you the map real quickly of where everything is right now, and you can see some of the new facilities that Joe was just talking about just a second ago. We do have a new transitional facility that will be opening up in Wake County very soon. That's on this map. We've got the Buncombe Detention Center that's going to be turned into a multi-purpose home that's identified on this map, and this is also in your report. I know it's hard to see on the screen, so you've got it in your report and in your slides, so you can see where everything kind of lays out on this plan. And on the next slide, this is really what we're trying to do. We're trying to develop a comprehensive plan in the state of North Carolina to serve juveniles in the system. The statute that Joe read to you earlier basically charged the department a long time ago, back in 1998, 1999, as YDC facilities closed, to reinvest that money back into the community. Because those kids that were no longer going to be served in YDCs are now being served in your local community. And we need to provide the communities with the resources to serve those kids. The reality is, in the state of North Carolina today, 75% of your felons are served in your local communities, and they're served more successfully in those local communities than they would be in a youth development center, because we can work with the family, we can work with their faith community, we can work with their school, all the partners that play a role in making sure that that child is going to develop into a responsible citizen are at the table at the local community. So we try everything we can in those local communities before we send them to a youth development center. So what you're seeing in this slide basically lays out how that system works. We have the JCPCs that are the foundation. I always think of it this way, that they're the foundation. Those are the basic services that courts can order a kid to go to in their local communities. They include things like restitution programs, community service programs, counseling programs that are available for kids and their families. And so those JCPCs really form that bottom level, that foundation of the continuum. Now, in local communities, and you may come from a local community where the JCPC funds in your area are maybe $40,000, $50,000. That's it for the whole county to serve the kids in those communities that are court involved. That's not enough money in some of those smaller counties. So then we have what we call level two services. These are for the more intensive kids that JCPC funds are not going to be able to serve because of the intensive needs of those kids. If those JCPC programs tried to fund all those kids, it would only be 3 or 4 kids that could be served in those programs often. So we have these more intensive services that are provided at a state level on the contractual level. So what you've got with the JCPC programs is you've got some residential programs that are provided, some restitution programs that are restorative justice type programs that are provided in those local communities. You got clinical and therapeutic programs that are provided in the local community. And finally, what we call structured activities, which would be like a structured day type program that kids can participate in their local community. Next, you've got those level two services that I was just talking about. I'm trying to give you the foundation because I want you to understand how these new services fit into this whole system. So in the level two services, we have in-home community-based programs that includes services that Eckerd and AMI provide across the state to kids in their homes with those families on a daily basis. These include things like functional family therapy, cognitive behavior therapy that they do with kids in those homes. It also includes short-term residential programs, such as the ones that Eckerd provides in Montgomery County and in Wilkes County. Those facilities serve kids for up to 4 to 5 months, just depending how long the kid needs to be in the program. It can be short as 90 days if the kid is doing really well in the program. And these are short-term residential placements. Next, we started this with a grant that we got to work with gang and kids that were involved in gangs. And we started a transition home. This one is in Craven County. And we have gotten outstanding results from this particular home. These are kids that go to youth development centers. They come out, and then they go to these transitional homes. And at the transitional home, they actually go to community college. They get a job. They start working towards, if they need a GED, they will work on the GED program. They are actually out in the community. They're getting these things done. 100% of the kids at the transition home right now are employed, have a job. When they leave the transition home, the Memphis Home for Children is the contractor that we work with on this program. They actually get them into an apartment or move them back home and help them get a job in their local community. They show them things like how to get a cell phone if they need a cell phone, how to write an application, how to do a resume. There's real basic skills that kids need to have if they're going to be successful when they're leaving the program. So far in this program, I'm thrilled to tell you we've got a 14% recidivism rate. You compare that against a kid that leaves a normal youth development center, it's 63%. So we've gone from 63% to 14%. Now, this is a brand new program. It's been operating now for almost 3 years, and we've got 24 months of recidivism data on these kids. So for 24 months, we've only had 14% recidivism in this program. And that's the program that we were talking about, that we want to reinvest some of the savings that we're going to get from closing these larger, old-fashioned youth development centers that weren't intended for the types of kids that we have today. We want to reinvest that money back into transitional homes in their local communities that the kids can go back to as a step-down program where they'll get community college or go to a university if they are eligible for that, and will get a job, get vocational skills that they need to be successful when they leave that home. Really excited about the opportunity to try this concept across the state. We've gotten such good results. And like I said, the first one was for all males. We're opening one in a couple months here. Memphis Home for Children is helping us start another one right here in Wake County that will be just for females. And so we're excited about the opportunity there. Finally, we have alternative to commitment projects. These are for kids that would otherwise be going to a youth development center. They actually can get committed and then be served in their local communities. And there's a full description of all of these programs in a report that was submitted to you earlier this year, which is an evaluation of the community program section. And you've got all the recidivism rates, but you've also got a comparison of how much money you're saving by serving these kids in their local communities in these programs versus sending them to a youth development center. We're talking about almost a third or fourth of the cost to serve them in these types of programs versus sending them to a youth development center, and the results are better. So why wouldn't you do it? Next, let's just look at the new services that we're talking about. One of the new services that we want to do is crisis beds. When we went out and looked and talked to court counselors across the state earlier this year and asked them, what is the service that you need in your area? What is the thing that you really need? We heard, especially in the central and eastern part of the state, they needed an alternative to detention that they could take kids to when their family or they are in crisis. They may be a runaway from home. They may be having a mental health problem. They may be having other issues. And what we find is with our kids, we take them to the crisis bed that's funded through mental health, and they kick them out because they say that our kids are too tough. So we want to have a dedicated place that we can send our kids to that will be a crisis bed situation. They get a full assessment. They would be there for less than 30 days, and in that 30 days, we do this full assessment that we would develop a short and long-term service plan for that child. And in that process, we would determine whether or not they need to go to a PRTF, a psychological residential treatment facility, or if they need to go, they can go back to their local community and have in-home intensive services in their local community, in their home, or do they need to go to a multi-purpose juvenile home and get the long-term service there. This would give us a real opportunity to assess what is the need of this child, what are their psychological needs, what are their physical mental health needs, their emotional needs that we need to address with this child to make sure they're going to be successful. And this is we think this will be a huge advantage in our system to allow us to get that type of information on these kids. What we find often is that we have kids that are in our detention centers, and they're awaiting placements at a mental health at a psychological residential treatment facility, and they stay in our detention centers waiting for that placement. We'd much rather them go to a place like this where they could get that full assessment, they would get a head start on their treatment as they're heading towards that psychological residential treatment facility if that's where they need to go. The other thing that we're looking at is additional multi-purpose juvenile home beds. That is the one that we're doing in Buncombe County. This could be for kids that are either in crisis, that could do the short-term model, or they could do the longer-term model that we do with our multi-purpose homes now. Those multi-purpose homes also do really well with level two kids. These are kids that are high risk or medium risk in your local communities. They go to these multi-purpose homes for, again, about a third or a fourth of the cost of going to a youth development center and have lower recidivism rates. So we want to open more of those beds. One of these would be in Buncombe County. The next thing that we want to do, so these are for kids before they go to youth development centers. The next thing that we want to do is, too often when a kid goes to a YDC, the parents wipe their hands of the kid. For 6 to 12 months, they get to say, they're gone. I don't have to deal with them. They've been causing me all this pain and torture for the last, 13 years. I don't have to deal with them. We want to change that dynamic. We want the parents to get more involved in the process. So what we want to do is, while a kid is committed to a youth development center, we want to require the parents to be part of the process with parenting classes, making them go through skill building that they learn. When this kid comes back, these are the types of things you need to be doing in your home to make sure this child's going to be successful when they come back. So that's part of the plan also. And we always talk about, when a kid goes to a youth development center or a multi-purpose home or any residential placement, the day to start talking about transition is the day the kid walks in the door. We're not going to wait until, 10 days before their release before we start to figure out what are we going to do with this kid once he gets out or she gets out. And finally, once they get out of commitment status or get out of a residential placement, we want to have reentry services for these kids. So the transitional homes that I told you about, 5 new transitional homes, we're going to look at the counties where kids are committed the most and place those transitional homes in those particular communities so that we can make sure that we can serve those kids in as close to their local community as possible. And then we want to do in-home transitional services for other kids. So if the service planning team says to us, this kid's not quite ready to go back to their home community, they would be the candidates for the transitional home. The reason we chose 40 beds is because we looked at the data. The data tells us that of the kids that enter our youth development centers, 40% of them, almost 40% of them, have parents that said, I mean, they told us, we're either unwilling or incapable of supervising our own kid. We know a child returning to that type of environment, guess what? They're not going to be very successful if the parents are not ready to get them back. So these transitional services that we're talking about, the transitional homes would be for those kids where the family's not ready for the kid to come back, and we can still work with that family, get them ready, or they can transition straight from this transitional home into independent living if that family's just going to tear them back down and get them back involved in the system. For those kids that have parents that are involved and can accept that kid back home, these in-home transitional services is what we're looking at. So these would be for those other kids that the family can be involved. We want to do functional family therapy, CBT, and look at what the national models are telling us are good models for reentry services. But those are two of services that we know work well with this type of client when they're returning home. And finally, the other big component to this is our court counselors. We want to invest in our court counselors by training them how to do what we call intensive case management. It's great for a court counselor to go to a kid's house and do a curfew check or go and see if they're following through their things on their probation, but we want them to dig a little bit deeper. We want them to try to figure out, what is the problem that's going on with this kid? What's going on in their local community? What's causing this kid to offend in the first place? So we're going to invest in training for our court staff to teach them how to do better case management with our kids so that they align the service that kid needs with what their risk and needs are showing us that they actually need in their community. No more do we want them to, try something out just to see if it works. We want them to choose the program that they know is going to work for this kid because it matches up with exactly what their service plan tells them that they need. So this intensive case management part will be for our court staff, and they're going to follow the kids throughout the system. They'll follow the kid before they go to commitment status, while they're in commitment status, and when they're in these transitional programs. So those are the new services that we're talking about with this plan. We're really excited about this opportunity. And a lot of the things that we're going to accomplish, we could not accomplish without the partnership that we've had with Adult Corrections. And there's no way that we could create 12 more beds on these the new YDC campuses that we want to create without the investment that Adult Corrections is going to do with us, with inmate labor, with their engineering department, with their maintenance department. Those are things that the old juvenile justice system did not have access to. We've got access to these services. That's why we can do all the things that we've described with just the $1.7 million it was going to take to build a kitchen at Dock. So we're really excited about the investment that we're going to get out of this, how it's going to let us reinvest in facilities that we know are safer for our kids and better for our kids, and it'll also allow us to do these new services that we think are going to be beneficial for kids. So at this time, I'm going to call up Commissioner Geis, and he's going to wrap the put a bow on this thing for everybody. I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Director Lassiter. Next, we'll have Lady Geis, Commissioner Geis. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's always good to be with you. And I'll tell you, it takes me a while to get around and shake all the hands of all the friends that I have here. But it is good to be with you today. Thank you so much. And, you know, I see that I can retire in a year or so because Billy can preach like I can. So we've got folks lined up. That's just great. Both Joe and Billy just did an exceptional job at sharing with you, and I'm not going to take much time today, and the committee has worked very hard to put this strategic plan together, and I think it definitely lays a roadmap for us as we move forward in the future. What I would like to key in on are some things that I believe about this plan. I believe this plan's vision not only right-sizes the state's juvenile justice operations, but it moves us in the right direction to make these operations the right fit at the right time for what we need today to reduce, prevent juvenile delinquency, and when required, appropriately intervene with youth in need and their families. I believe we are fully doing what GS 143V806 directs us to do by moving away from youth development centers to evidence-based community programs. I believe that we are doing the right thing by using existing appropriated funds to complete the renovation projects and the staffing at the new locations that support the direction we want to go. And it does so at no additional cost to the citizens of the state of North Carolina. I want to repeat that. And it does so at no additional cost to the citizens of the state of North Carolina. I believe that we are doing the right thing in using facilities more efficiently, using facilities that the state already has funds committed to, and most importantly, using facilities that are safer for our youth and our staff. I believe that it is important that we study the youth transportation system to see how we can make it safer and more efficient. I believe it is important that we plan and prepare for possible future expansion in the juvenile justice system. I believe this plan does all those things, and I believe that our dedicated management team and staff are prepared to make this strategic plan a success. But also, I believe that to complete this plan successfully, we need your support of this plan. Your support in being able to use the $1.7 million repair and renovation funds previously dedicated to be used for the Dobbs Kitchen repair, to be used instead to cover the cost of the capital improvements indicated in this plan. Certainly, it is, I believe, a much better use than the $1.7 million initially assigned. Wouldn't you agree? your support in our working with GovOps to transfer funds from closed YDCs to support the staffing and operational cost to operate at the newer, safer, and more efficient facilities, and to be able to reinvest those funds into the very important community-based programs we are proposing. I cannot overemphasize that this transfer of state funds from closed YDCs to these operations must be allowed in order for this plan to be implemented successfully, and I'm asking for your help in moving forward with that as the time comes. It is truly a privilege today to stand before this distinguished committee and provide detailed information about our juvenile justice system in North Carolina. I want to take this opportunity to thank my staff for their hard work and dedication in the preparation of this report. You know, we have an opportunity every day to do the right thing. Most folks that are around me will tell you I talk often about the fact that I feel so privileged to have the opportunity to be in the position that I'm in. And I know that God puts us where we are for a reason, but also for a season. We're not going to be in this position forever, and you're not going to be in your position forever. It's all about doing the right thing while we have that opportunity. We need your support and help as we move forward to deal with this very difficult issue of juvenile justice. We feel we've looked at our facilities, we've engaged our staff, and I think we've put together an exceptional plan. I would say possibly one of the best plans that's come through the legislature in some time. And you know, we didn't have to go out and get an outside group, didn't have to spend money to do it. We got people within our organization that had the years of experience and the knowledge to assist us in doing this great work. So we ask for your support, and I would like to tell you that we are honored to be hosting the National Partnership for Juvenile Justice in Greensboro, the National Conference, in October 2014. So we're excited about that opportunity that's going to be coming our way also. Madam Chairman, we would be glad, and I say we, my partners that have helped us, and our folks that are here that are experts, would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, if y'all will come back up here so we'll have all three of you together. And our first person that had his hand up was Senator Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I'm not sure, Secretary Geist, thank you for being here, and I appreciate very much the presentation from your colleagues, Mr. Laster and Mr. Prater. I first would like to say, if I could, I appreciate the work and the strategic thinking that has gone into this plan. I'm encouraged that I think that juvenile justice appears to be moving in the right direction as far as stability. There's some, you're right, Secretary Geist, I mean, this we have few opportunities to really do, make sure we're doing the right thing. And I've only been here for 3 years. I've seen quite a few changes in juvenile justice in just that short period of time. And I'll be gone one day, as will others. And so I want to make sure we do the right thing. So I'd like to ask you a couple of questions, if I could, because in particular about these YDC centers, one of the things I'll note by observation is that when I first got here, and we were unfortunately cast in the budget cutting mode, the severe budget cutting mode, the Department of Public Safety and others, there was a great push to close some of these YDC centers, Edgecombe in particular, and somewhat with Lenore. And as I recall, and of course y'all are proposing reopening them, we were told that they were too expensive to operate, that model was too expensive, and that we had to go with the older Dobbs. And you remember that, don't you, Secretary? I mean, you were with us in all of that. And as I recall, Dobbs was left open, that Lenore was left open because Dobbs didn't have kitchen facilities. And then when we went through this exercise again, just this last long session, it came up again. And to close Lenore, if I recall correctly, and I said, well, wait a minute, what about the food? How are they gonna feed them at Dobbs? And so that's where this money, I don't know, it was just me, but that's in part where the money came from. So I feel like I'm clinging to a yo-yo, and it's going up and down really quick, and I'm hanging on for dear life. And so I'm not opposed to reopening these centers. I just want to make that observation to the committee that, we close them, we open them, we close them, we open them. You know, I hope that this plan is going to be have some real stability, and that we've got the right model and the right plan going forward if we're going to reopen these facilities. And so I guess my question, that was kind of a long statement, I apologize for that, but I might have missed it in the presentation, and I apologize for flipping through things and trying to pay attention at the same time. There's an increase in detention center beds. Do we really have a need for that?
Thank you, Mr. Senator. We certainly appreciate the question and recapping some history. One of the things that I learned as we began this process, there's a lot of history, and it was very interesting going back and gathering information about our history and how far we've come. One of the points that really stood out to me, and then I'll answer your question, but one of the points that stood out to me was in 1969, I believe it was, when North Carolina led the way in locking up young people in the entire country. It's not something that we're very proud of, but we had more children in YDCs than any other state in the country. Well, we've made that change. Today, you can go in and look at the materials in front of you, and you can see that we have very few young people locked up in YDCs. In fact, the number today, I believe, was 220. So we have made a significant change, and that's because we're doing a lot of things on the front end. We've learned that we can better serve these young people by serving them out in the community, and we've done some exceptional work there. What we have tried to do with this strategic plan is look at all of our facilities and our programming as a whole. It first started out just focusing on the facilities, but we needed to look at all of our facilities and our programming and how we were going to manage in the communities, etc. And what this plan does, it does close some of the older facilities, and it does bring back and reopen some of the smaller, newer facilities. The two facilities that we closed, Lenore and Edgecombe, we closed them while we still had a debt of over $8 million. That's something that we considered. In addition, we looked at the staffing pattern of those facilities, and we were able to go in with our engineers' help and create some additional beds at those facilities, which we feel we still meet that national model, but we can take care of more folks in a pod than we had in the past. Our facility at Dobbs, a much older facility, is right across the street from Lenore, and it doesn't even have a fence. And the Lenore facility, for example, has a fence and a kitchen. And Dobbs has no fence and no kitchen, and buildings that are falling down. So that's just an example. But I do feel like that what we've attempted to do is lay out a plan for the future. I do want to tell you that I believe very firmly that if we need a facility in the future, we have the Dobbs grounds there to add on or to build a facility. We just believe that we have to think ahead and plan for the future and have a plan. So that is in the plan for future growth if we need it there. But most of the buildings at that location, other than the building there at Dobbs, vocational building, other than the vocational building, are pretty
question about the detention numbers. If, and it's an if, and it really depends on this body, but there will be a question at some point in the future with regards to the juvenile age, and are we going to remain the state, one of two states, us in New York, that still have the juvenile age where we've got it? Are we going to change that? What we have learned is that more than likely where you will see the biggest need if that change is made, changing that juvenile age, will be at the detention center, not the YDC. So it's interesting when you get in and you study that, but the other matter is the transportation issue. That is the big matter, because that affects our local sheriffs on the weekends and at night when someone is having to be moved. It affects our staff in the community, our court counselors that have to drive, like in the West now, if you're in Macon or Clay County, you've got to take someone all the way to Alexander County. Then you've got to go back home. Then the next day you might have to get up and drive back and pick them up and bring them to court and back and forth. We're working on that, but we just didn't have enough time to get that taken. I answered two or three questions there.
Okay, thank you. Next, Representative Charles Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I wanted to go up there and get out on my knees with you. That would sound like a call to the altar to me, and I really appreciate your staff's input and insight and progressive thinking along this line. We're talking about our youth. Although these youth are children who obviously have problems, and your thinking is progressive, and I like that thinking. You're talking about being proactive as we work with these children, as opposed to being reactive, putting them away and not really addressing their concerns, and I'm really appreciative of what you're saying this morning. I really want to praise you for your insight here and talking about evidence-based practices. Reentry for youth. You know, I've heard a lot of that being talked about for our adults, but reentry for youth is, you know, I think that's wonderful, and I think we have to really become proactive as we try to move these children or young adults back into the mainstream of our society. And I don't think there's any way we can do that without having a plan to reenter those kids back into our society, and hopefully put them on sound footing to be successful. Family involvement, you know, it's so encouraging to hear you talk about family involvement and trying to get our families to accept their children back. But the reality is, some of our parents may not have the tools to do that. And to stand before this committee and say we're looking at that and we're concerned about that and we want to do something to encourage those families and to support those families. You know, we know that we have parents who don't know how to be parents. And for some of our children, it's not too late to, I think, to get our parents involved at that level and give them the supports they needed and need to have that child come back to the community. Community-based, I love it. I love it. I think these children need to have an opportunity to live in their communities and get back into communities and become productive citizens. I just want to commend you and the staff for what you're doing, and I'm with you 100%. Our youth is our most greatest asset, and I support what you're doing, and you got my vote, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Graham. Representative McNeil.
Thank you. You've already addressed some of what my question was when I raised my hand, but I'll start off by saying I like your plan. Your staff has done a great job. You and your staff has done a great job in coming, and I like the fact that this plan kind of looks at the whole picture and not just parts and pieces, and it's good. But the part that question I had about was the transportation, and I know you already talked about that just a second ago. It was Senator Newton's question, and I understand from your comments then that that is a piece that you haven't worked out yet, and there's still a lot of work to do. And you already mentioned the fact that it does impact the local police and the sheriff's office. So I'd just like to say that when you do your study and you look at that further, I think you ought to have them at the table in any plans that you're looking at going forward with.
Just in way of response, as we began this process, we were looking at potentially doing some different things with detention facilities, and had one of our regional administrators from the east call me and say, you know, we've got to make sure we communicate well with our partners, the sheriffs, the law enforcement folks back home. Joe and I truly have learned a great deal through this process. Now, Billy is an old hand at this, and he helped to get us to where we needed to be, but it was really the people back in the back room here that helped educate us so much about what we really needed to do. But the great thing about it was we had folks in that room from the adult side, engineering, various functions within the department, and we were all trying to find a way to really make things better. And on the transportation piece, for us, we want to make sure we have certified staff. Now we do not have certified transportation folks, so we have contracts. Well, you know, that can create problems for you at times, and what I'm hearing from them is we need to have people that are certified to do the work and transporting our children, but we also need to make sure that we not only provide the piece from moving one, say, from a county to a detention facility, but I've got to be able to help court counselors who are already overburdened with the work that they need to be doing, taking them out of that transportation piece back and forth. And I would like to say to you on families, one thing that Billy has really taught us and we've really bought into is the fact that we know that if a young person is in a YDC and not in the community, something major has happened. But we also know that person will never be successful if we don't get in and work with the family while they're in the YDC, because they will, if the family is dysfunctional, putting the child in the YDC is not going to help the family get any better. We've got to do something to engage that family and get them to where, and maybe they won't ever be, but at least we'll know, and it'll help us place the person where they need to be. But we've got to be able to engage at that level. And we somewhat are having to change a culture, too. When you talk about a more intensive level of managing that caseload, et cetera, we're changing how our staff has thought over the years. So we're all growing, not only in the juvenile world, but the adult world, too.
All right. I have Representative Speciale next.
Not having been able to read the whole thing, obviously, what I can see of it is it looks excellent, and I certainly would applaud the fact that you didn't spend $200,000 and hire an outside group to come up with this plan. You use the expertise you have, and I think that's great. As we talked earlier, in earlier sessions about some of these places, Dobbs, Lenora, which is what I want to focus on, it's hard to get an understanding. You know, we talk about the new one, the old one, and unless you've been there and seen it, you know, it's hard to grasp it. Well, I had the opportunity to go up there and look at it, and I can easily understand why you have the plan the way you have it. That new facility is sitting there idle. You can't do anything with it. You can't sell it because you need that kitchen. The old facility, obviously, it's not worth putting that kind of money into it. There's no way, because as soon as you get that done, you're going to have to start focusing on some of those other buildings that are World War II era asbestos filled. I know you've done the best you can with with maintenance and everything else, but I don't have to be a space scientist to be able to figure out that it's got to cost a lot more to maintain what you have than what you would have if you went across the street. So for those of you that haven't seen these facilities, you know, if you need that to convince you to support this plan, go take a look at it. And I want to commend your staff that took the time to walk me through and show me everything at both facilities. Thank you.
Senator Bryan.
Thank you, ma'am.
Chairman. I have two questions. One is, first is just to understand the math a little bit about about the $6,954. That's net. You're returning to the general. What are you doing with that? What's going to happen with that money, and how do you get this net out of the whole thing? Just kind of walk me through it.
Please use a mic.
And I've got the bean counter right here that's going to answer that, I'm sure. Joe.
Thank you. Joe Prater, Deputy Commissioner. Senator Bryant, I think in terms of this scorecard, the $690,000 is a reduction from what the annual operating budget was overall previously. When you run this scenario through, it's essentially $690,000 less than it was before you implement the plan. And we call that a net because that gives me an opportunity to reemphasize that means after all the scenarios have played out that we want to have play out, transfer of funds, et cetera. So bottom line is that's the bottom line. It's the reduction of the overall operating budget.
And that is after you reinvest the savings that you want to reinvest from closing the YDC. That's what I'm trying to understand.
Joe Prater, Deputy Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
All right.
Yes, ma'am, that is absolutely correct. Excellent question. That is after those have occurred. That's what you have at the end of this.
But and in order to make this plan work, though, you have to have the 1.7 million, which is not a part of this calculation. Is that right? Because it's on the capital side, or is it in there somewhere?
Joe Prater, Deputy Commissioner. Yes, ma'am, that is correct. That's over on the capital side. However, it is in play, and we do need the 1.7 to make this work out because it is actually the entire thing. So yes, the 1.7 million is needed to be able to achieve that.
So two more questions in the same arena. Okay. So what will happen to the $690,000? Are there other do you see that going into other juvenile justice or DPS needs, or coming back to the general fund for school teachers? I mean, where does that go?
Joe Prater, Deputy Commissioner. No, ma'am, we would not like for it to go to the general fund. We would like to be able to reinvest that additionally into the operations to continue to support where we're trying to go. That is being earmarked primarily at this point for two things that we'd like to have time to work out. One would be the detention center additional staff. We've got some issues with the detention center staffing that we'd like to possibly address with those funds. But also it's the transportation. So we'd like to be able to take what funds we can to try to move in that direction. Not really sure that fits like a glove, but basically you're pointing us in the right direction. That is, yes, we'd like to reuse those funds for reinvestment.
And one last thing, Madam Chair. What official action were you wanting or looking for us, looking to us from today? If any, maybe you just want us to hear the report. I don't know.
Well, we need this body's support for us to be successful with the reallocation of the $1.7 million. We would need the support, I think, of this group of folks. And additionally, I believe we would have to go to GovOps for the transfer of those monies, and we would need the support of this group for that. I will tell you the general statute that we've all quoted over and over and over clearly indicates as it relates to closure of YDCs and the spending of that money is to be reinvested back into community programs, etc., which that's part of that $600,000 we're talking about. But the $1.7 million that's used for the renovations, we're just asking, and we'll ask GovOps to allow us to shift that money from the kitchen to these other areas.
Madam Chair, if it's the pleasure of the chairs and at the appropriate time, if you want something done.
I understand we'll be doing this in appropriations, our appropriations committee, instead of in here. Well, I think we need a vote. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
I wonder if this is called justice reinvestment again in a different manner. Just wondering. Representative George Graham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had one or two questions that I would like to get an answer to, and I spent, for your information, 13 years as a director at Dobbs Training School in Kinston, and I still live in Monroe County, so I'm very familiar with what we're discussing here. But I wanted to talk about two things that maybe you didn't mention, and that was our treatment program. What type of treatment program are you running that will cause a kid to be released from training school? Also, teachers with the educational program, vocational or academic, are you looking at hiring or engaging certified teachers? Or what are some of the educational services that you will be offering? And what is your program? What is your treatment model?
Mr. Laster.
William Laster, Director of Community Programs. Thank you for the question. What we're doing is the same program that we put in place when we started those newer facilities. It's a model of care that we have implemented. And basically what it looks at is using CBT, which is cognitive behavior therapy. It also utilizes a system where kids have to learn up to 50 skills while they're actually at the facility. Simple skills such as how to accept no as an answer. You know, a lot of our kids that come into the facilities don't have that skill. But there are 50 of these skills that they have to learn, and they have to get signatures while they're in the facility to get those skills that designate that they've developed those. The service planning team, which is made up of the social workers, the psychologists, the court counselor, the staff at that other staff, the teachers at that facility, help to direct what those skills are that the kid needs to learn while they're in the youth development center. One of the unique things about this particular plan would be that if we do these transitional homes, if the kid shows that they've made the progress within 6 months, which is what the law requires them to stay in a YDC, they could go ahead and step down to one of these transitional facilities in their local community and start getting back involved in local things like their church or their school right away instead of waiting 12 months or 13 or 14 months. We can do that at a lesser cost in their local community, and we can get better results from that. And the good thing about the transitional homes also is that we're going to use the same types of model of care that we're using in the YDCs when they go down to these transitional facilities. So the kids will be exposed to the same types of skills. We're not going to restart everything once they move to these other facilities. We do use certified teachers currently in our youth development centers. That would still be the case. In our multi-purpose homes, we use certified teachers. And even in our residential short-term programs, we use certified teachers. They have to use the standard course of study that's adopted in the state of North Carolina. And most of the kids in our facilities make good gains while they're in our youth development centers, and even better gains when they're in our multi-purpose homes in our short-term residential programs. A lot of those kids only stay for 3 or 4 months and make a year and a half to 2 years of progress academically while they're in those programs.
One follow-up, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Do you have children or students engaged with the community colleges, and if so, are they paying tuition, or are you paying the tuition?
Currently, we do have some community college courses that kids can participate in, the GED program they're allowed to participate in. There are vocational programming that we offer, especially down at Dobbs. If you've been to the facility lately, we did renovate that vocational center down there. We're still going to use that vocational center if we use Lenore. The kids will be able to go across the street to get those classes. We're working with Lenore Community College, for example, in that area. The kids that are in our transitional homes, the one in Craven County, we do have the kids enrolled in community college. A lot of our kids get those classes are offered to them as part of the program. And even with Methodist Home for Children, if they graduate from their multi-purpose homes or from this transitional home, Methodist continues to help them with the Hackley Scholarship to help them continue their community college so they don't have to pay going forward. And that's all done with private donations that they get, that they give to the kids.
Does anyone else on the committee have any questions? I just have a couple. In the transitional homes, I think you said there's one already in Craven County. Was there any pushback? Is it a neighborhood, or is it a building that y'all have? Or
William Laster, Director of Juvenile Community Programs. Yes, ma'am. It used to be a multi-purpose home that we had in Craven County already, so we just converted it to a transitional home. And so there wasn't any pushback really in that local community because it was already serving those types of kids.
Was it? Is it paid for? Is it rented, or what is it? Does the state own it?
Yes, ma'am. The state does own it. We own all the multi-purpose homes are owned by the state, and we do the maintenance on them unless it's below a certain threshold. I think it's $500. then the contracted provider, Methodist Home for Children, does that move.
Okay, and I have a question on the parenting. I know you assess the juveniles, and I guess they're done in crisis at the crisis center. Where is the crisis center? Where would these crisis beds be? In a hospital or in a facility or where?
We're going to convert the old D cottage unit at Dillon to be that crisis bed unit. So it would be a state-owned facility, and we would have a private contractor come in and actually do the services like we do with the multi-purpose homes now. And if this model works, it would be the same thing that we would try in Buncombe County also, because right now, if a kid needs to go to detention in the western part of the state, they're having to travel all the way to Alexander County. So we want Buncombe Detention to basically serve as a multi-purpose home, but also as an alternative to detention, that a kid could get a crisis assessment done, and would cut the travel time and maybe closer to their home community.
Thank you. Are the homes or the parents assessed also?
Yes, ma'am. As part of the risk and needs assessment that we do when a kid is intake into the system, that is part of the process that we go through, is evaluating the family members. And we actually have a service that we call functional family therapy that can be subscribed to kids that are really having problems at home. And it's been really successful with working with those kids.
Okay, thank you. It sounds like a great plan. Representative Neal has one more question.
Yeah, when you asked that question about transition homes, it kind of jogged my memory on something. I know your plan says to open 5 new transition homes, and is that in addition to the 2 that you've listed here, which would be a total of 7? Or what criteria are you using, or how are you deciding where those homes are going to be?
Yes, sir, that is correct. We're going to use the 2 that we have now, and then 5 more is the plan. And those 5, we identified the 5 by just looking at the needs of kids coming out of the facilities today, and those kids that didn't have a supportive home to go back to. That's the number that we came up with of how many beds we would need for transitional homes. We want to look at those communities where kids are most committed, so we'd be looking at Durham, Cumberland County, Mecklenburg County, but I think we'd also look at a couple of rural areas also for some of those for those transitional homes also, because we do have some kids at the Craven home, for example. We have some kids that are being served there that are gang involved, and they can't go back to their local community, mainly because of a threat against their own life if they do go back to those local communities. So we want to serve them outside of their local community and get them established somewhere else once they leave the transitional home.
Representative Mobley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am certainly delighted to hear some of the changes and upgrades and renovations and changing of the guards about what's going on with juveniles. I do have a couple of questions. One is with regard to the facility that was located in for Clemens County, I think it was a detention facility. Are there plans to do anything with that?
Currently, there's nothing in the plan that's looked at that, but I think if it would be appropriate for some other type of community service, it's something that we could look at, as would Dobbs. We could look at Dobbs being a structured day program in the future, if that is a program, if that is a utilizing that vocational part of the building. But the actual performance one is not on the table right at the moment.
Question number 2. I heard mentioned in the report, Commissioner Geis mention of if we have to go to changing the age. How many children do you feel, or how many young people do you feel you can adjust to receiving if there was a change in the age?
Yes, ma'am. This plan does take into account that we could have additional capacity. We could use the old detention center that's at Dillon, for example. There's an actual old detention center there. We had the Perquimans one. We could also use the grounds at Dobbs, as the commissioner told you earlier, where we could build a more regionalized detention center there also. So we've planned for that in this plan. You'll see in the very back part of the plan, there's a taking into account how we could serve kids if that age was raised, and we wanted to think through that process in this plan. And of course, it depends on how the legislation is written on how many kids would come into the system.
And if I might add, it really does depend on how the legislation is written. As it's written today, it focuses on the misdemeanor population. If that was how the bill was passed, we would see some effect, but much more effect if felons were part of that plan. I would tell you that, in my opinion, sometimes I get in trouble for giving my opinion, but I do it often. In my opinion, if you're going to address the age, you need to address it completely, which would include the felons, not just the misdemeanors. So it's something that I think at some point the legislature will have to address, but I think that clearly, we have the state adult system, that age group. Again, this is the group that's incarcerated. This is not folks that are under community supervision, but we have about 90 folks that are of 16, 17-year-old that are incarcerated. Years ago, it was much, much higher, but we have about 90 today. And, of course, you know we have about 201, 220 in the YDCs today. But it's much bigger than just looking at the facility, because you've got to look at the community piece. But I will tell you, and I believe I shared this the other day with some of the governor's staff that talked with us, clearly when the issue is discussed, we will be glad to weigh in on that issue. I think at some point the issue will be discussed and a decision will be made there, without doubt.
Thank you, Commissioner Geisen. I still serve, I do serve on the committee with regard to the age change, and you may be called on to come and talk with us at some point.
We'll be glad to. Be glad to bring my experts too.
Thank you so much for helping us today and for presenting and talking to us and making us clear on this plan, and we'll be discussing it. Thank you. Next, we have Ann Preside, Director of Community Supervision, Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Preside, and I'm the Director for Community Supervision for Adult and Juvenile Justice. I had an inquiry as to the frequency of which probation officers were sitting in the courtrooms, and I appreciate that inquiry because it caused us to review all of our counties and the local practices. Historically, probation officers sat in courtrooms for an inordinate amount of time waiting for their probation violation hearings to occur. Since our review, I give credit to our district managers who have worked very well with the judiciary, with their district attorneys, and in most of our county, they have developed a process so that the officers are not spending a large amount of time day after day each week of court. Superior Court seems to take the most time for our officers, and that is due to variables that are beyond most anyone's control in the courtroom, as to how soon cases break down, if they decide to take pleas from the jail, if it's an administrative week. Lots of different variables go into consideration there. So overall, I'm very pleased at having conducted this exercise and reviewing the amount of time. Most counties do have a plan, and in the counties that we identified, we're working with our local managers to make sure that that they're communicating with the judiciary and that our staff are doing probation officer work as much as possible.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Well, thank you. Maybe it'll make our courtrooms more efficient and our probation officers be out there working. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next we have Eliza Wolfer, Financial Fiscal Officer, Office of Indigent Defense Services. The recruitment trends. Welcome. You need to speak into the mic.
The committee had asked for some information about recruitment with Indigent Defense Services. Those are the revenues we receive from former clients who have been convicted, portion of our budget. So just a fairly brief overview of how that system works and some statistics on it. For the current year, we're budgeted to receive $13 million in recruitment receipts. That's almost exactly the amount we actually received last year. For the current fiscal year, we're actually projecting to run just a little bit short of that. That's the first time that's happened in a long time. But we had anticipated that with the decrease in the hourly rates paid in 2011. Just real briefly, there's statutory basis for the recruitment process. The statutes are in a couple different places depending on the type of case. There's two major sources. One is the actual attorney's fees, which varies by case based on how much time was in the case, and then the appointment fee, which is a flat fee that doesn't vary by case. Different statutes for each of those. There are federal constitutional standards sort of overseeing the recruitment process based on case law. The North Carolina system's been seen to be consistent with those standards. I'll talk about that in a minute, but first I was going to say the initial basis of where the whole recruitment process starts is when someone is in court, requests a court-appointed attorney, they submit an affidavit of indigency, and right there on the affidavit, it tells them that a court-appointed attorney is not free and that if they are convicted, they will be required to pay it back. This is the language that's actually on the affidavit of indigency, that notice. To the client is an important part of the federal standards and of our system. There's the other constitutional standards that are important in the process is that it not be overly cumbersome, that the collection process not be extreme, and that someone can't be in prison for failing to pay when that failure to pay is due to indigency rather than some other cause. The types of cases that Indigent Defense Services handles primarily criminal cases, and almost all of our recruitment is from the criminal cases at the trial level, and so most of the other remarks here are related to those. Recruitment is possible also in juvenile delinquency cases. The juvenile is by definition indigent, but the judge can find another party liable. And similarly, abuse, neglect, dependency, the judge can order recruitment, but has to take specific action to do that because there is a presumption that there really aren't any resources there given the nature of the cases. But in criminal cases, it's automatic. The judge doesn't have to do anything specific to make it a recruitment eligible case at that point. Indigent Defense Services are delivered by several different kinds of systems right now. The bulk is our court-appointed attorneys where they're appointed to an individual case, and the fee application they submit is also the paper vehicle that the court uses for recruitment. So that's a good system because there's tremendous incentive to the attorney to submit that paperwork in a timely fashion, and right there on the fee application is the legal language that's required for whether it be part of the bill of costs or later a docketing of civil judgment. For our public defender programs and our newer contractor systems, we don't have that fee application for payment system, but so our defender programs use a form that is the same as the fee application form, but they only submit it to the clerk's office if there is going to be recruitment. It doesn't affect their payment. There's no payee with it. It just is the same form and the same legal vehicle for recruitment. And similarly, with our newer contractor system, those contractors enter their data into an online web-based system, and if the case is one where recruitment will be due, it generates, spits out a form that they can then take to the clerk's office that looks a lot like a fee application form, but again, does not involve paying anybody because they're paid on a monthly basis, not by that case. The major sources where the money comes in is, the biggest source is attorney's fees that are collected through the clerk's office, through the FMS system. We get a daily deposit. That's about $6.3 million a year. That same system also collects the flat appointment fee, and that's about another $1.4 million. The other big place where we get our recruitment receipts is through the set-off debt program, intercepting state tax refunds and, to a lesser degree, lottery winnings. And so the amount collected last year for attorney's fees was $4.7 million, another $500,000 in appointment fees. That $4.7 million figure from set-off debt, a lot of that is interest, because some of these judgments that have resulted in the intercepted tax refund can be very old, and they accrue interest at 8%, which is a statutorily set rate. So that dollar amount doesn't necessarily represent that there was that much paid out in attorney's fees, because some of those judgments, they can be 10, 15, 20 years old, although some are more recent. That's the trends in recruitment. Through FMS, as you can see, there was, when IDS started a couple of years ago, 12 years ago, there was only about $2 million in total recruitment. But looking just in recent years, there was a big jump in the dollar amounts when the system became more automated a number of years ago. But going back to 2009, you can see that there was steady increase, and then just last year, starting to see that decrease. And that, again, was expected when the hourly rate was decreased in 2011, that the less we're paying out to attorneys, the less we're going to recruit. The item we look at the most is the attorney's fees collected through the clerks, as opposed to the total that also includes the appointment fee. The appointment fee was increased a couple years ago, and so that helped mitigate the drop in the actual attorney's fees. As you can see that, again, the decline from fiscal year 11 to the current year, and this year is projected to be even less than last year. Some of the factors affecting recruitment, of course, the biggest factor is the amount paid to the attorneys, because that's the basis for the recruitment, other than the interest that accrues. But one of the other major factors is the disposition of the case. If the case is dismissed or if the person's acquitted, then they do not owe the money back. So we estimate, we don't have excellent data yet, because we base it based on the disposition data on our fee applications, that about two-thirds of the cases are recruitment eligible. You know, there's certain classes of cases where we don't ever expect any recruitment. We don't expect any recruitment on capital cases and things of that sort. And so that right away takes a big chunk of the payments that are paid out off the table in terms of recruitment. The other sort of important factor is the submission of the paperwork, the fee application, or the in lieu of fee application items we have, and how that paperwork is processed in the clerk's office. It's one of, you know, a lot of different things the clerk's offices do. They're processing the paperwork, both in terms of getting it to our financial services offices for payment purposes, but also for properly either setting it up as a bill of costs in the FMS system, or where in other cases, docketing it as a civil judgment. And so because it is a paper-based system and a complex system, that's an important factor. And then, of course, what we can't model or really predict is whether that client has any money to pay. We know in certain situations there isn't money to pay. Indigency, when they're given a court-appointed attorney, is sort of a point in time, and if someone is on probation and still in the community working, there is some expectation that they can pay it off, but that also is based on a lot of other factors that we can't predict on a statewide basis or really even analyze too well. In terms of set-off debt, that's the one that's most difficult to predict, because you can have someone who has a judgment from years ago but has never gotten a state tax refund. The judgment was properly docketed in the civil system. That information is sitting there at the Department of Revenue, but if they don't get a tax refund, nothing will ever happen. The civil judgments can sit there a long time unless there's something involving a property transfer or the lottery winnings or state tax refund. What are some of the obstacles to increasing recruitment receipts for IDS? One is, there's a statutory list of when funds are collected in the clerk's office. usually from probationers were at disposition. And attorney's fees is the lowest of the priorities. There's a lot of things ahead of it, including restitution and some of the other court's fees. I think one of the earlier presentations talked about cases where someone is given 30 days to pay, or unsupervised probation cases where the only sort of requirement after disposition is to pay the various fees. And we know that that it is a difficult process to follow up on all those, and that's not an insignificant number of our cases. What we always talk about is the handoff in the clerk's office, is that the collection of a lot of the fees that we get through the clerk's offices is while the person is on probation or immediately at disposition. Often you'll have someone complete probation, they've successfully completed probation, nobody's interested in extending probation just for the fact that they owe some of their attorney's fees. Well, at that point, those fees are supposed to be docketed as a civil judgment, which means that if there's a tax refund or something else, we would eventually get it. Well, that requires a handoff from two very different pieces of the clerk's office, you know, from the cashier, bookkeeper, to the civil division. And in most cases, that happens well, but again, because it's a paper-based system and in a larger clerk's office, we think that handoff can either delay things or sometimes cause things not to be docketed. And we do have some concern that with the transition to the contractor system, because there's no longer that strict incentive to get your fee application in, which is the vehicle for recruitment, that we think no matter how much we encourage and try to make it easy, that there it will inevitably be some drop off in that percentage. The other thing is the system is very complex. What happens in a given court case varies a lot. And so we get a lot of questions. What do you do if it's an interim? What do you do if it's a withdrawal where it was initially a court appointed attorney and then the client retains attorney? What do you do if it's a deferral or a prayer for judgment? And so the complexity of the system does get in the way. At the point something's docketed for a civil judgment, the Social Security number is the most important piece of information. It's on the fee applications form. Most of the fee application forms have it, but not all of them. And if it's missing, or if the attorney can't obtain it, that is an obstacle to a valid civil judgment. And then inevitably the workload and turnover in the clerk's office is because they play such a crucial role in the recruitment is a factor. And I think finally, as other fees have gone up for anyone who has a criminal conviction, that of course makes it that much harder for those dollars to reach us from attorney's fees. We do look at a recruitment rate, which is basically just taking how much we received in recruitment as a percentage of what we spent on non-capital cases in that same year, even though the recruitment may well be based on prior year's cases. And that's, as you can see, that's sort of, it's around 12%, it's gone up and down. I expect that to stabilize at around the 12% rate, and, you know, absent any major changes. I think the increase we saw for a couple of years was we were still recouping based on the higher hourly rates, but spending less when we cut the hourly rates. And that rate itself varies tremendously by county. We know in general that the urban counties recoup a much lower percentage, and we attribute that both to, it can be to the culture in those counties, whatever's happening by the judges, size of the clerk's office. It's things that we can't exactly put our fingers on. We know the higher percentages we see in smaller counties isn't really indicative of something. I think we collected 120% of what we spent in Tyrell County last year, and that's just because there was one big judgment and not very much money spent. And so there's so many actors affecting what that recruitment amount coming in is. We can't really totally explain the variation among the counties. Things we'd like to do to try to get a handle on this as we can, similar to what somebody talked about earlier, we try to do some periodically. We can go look at clerk's files and, you know, pull a few files and say, well, what happened in this case? We can either do that with the various electronic systems. We're actually looking at the paper systems. It's very time consuming. I spent about 25 minutes looking at one example yesterday, looking in FMS, looking in the criminal system, looking in the civil system. And that sort of explained to me that everything had happened correctly in that case. We didn't collect any money, but it wasn't due to any error, and that was 20 minutes later on one case. So that's a very time consuming thing. And we do, when we notice that a county is on the lower end of the recruitment percentage, we do try to, as we have the opportunity, talk to clerk staff, judges staff. And I think I've said that anytime we sit down with everybody involved, we'll find one little thing that maybe could be done differently or that was misunderstood or that was a form that was changed. But again, that's very time consuming. We do work with the Court Services Division at AFC when they do trainings for the clerk staff. We almost always do a session on how to handle attorney's fees and the whole recruitment process, and I think that's been very helpful. In terms of new approaches, the one idea, and our director mentioned this in a presentation before this committee or another committee earlier point this interim, was because the system's so complex, if we made it more uniform and simpler, instead of saying, well, the fee application and the amount paid in that case is the basis for recruitment, if instead we said, if it's a DWI, the amount you're going to owe is such and such. You know, if it's a Class H felony, the amount you're going to owe is such and such, and we would choose an amount that was indicative or average or probably low average. The problem with that is it wouldn't be as fair to the someone whose case was disposed of much quicker. They'd be owing more than was the actual cost paid to the attorney. And we certainly couldn't guarantee that it would increase receipts. We just know that it would simplify the process. So that's just an idea, not something we're necessarily advocating, but if we were going to take a very different approach to it, that would be one way. The other thing, which is not something we see as feasible, is that if there were staff in clerk's offices, you know, dedicated to seeing the recruitment process through, in the early days, we did note that in some counties where recruitment was particularly successful, there was someone in that office who had been doing it for years, who was really dedicated to seeing that it was done right. But we don't necessarily think that the increased revenues would offset the extra cost of that. We do have one receipt-supported person working part-time in Mecklenburg County. The position started for other reasons, and they do help with making sure that all the holes are filled. I think they believe that the people supervising that position believe that it helps with recruitment, but I don't think we could necessarily extrapolate to that to smaller clerk's offices. And we have very limited data on what's happening in recruitment. We get a daily deposit to the FMS, a dollar amount. Once a month, we get a list of how much was collected in each county. That gives us the opportunity, if some county is collecting nothing, you know, we can follow up on that, usually using the AOC staff that work with the clerk's offices and use to make sure there's nothing that we need to address. That certainly helped us a number of years ago. There were a number of counties that weren't consistently collecting the appointment fee, and we used those lists to identify those and to make sure that those that was mostly just misunderstanding, getting those processes straightened out. The other thing that we are able to use data for is our staff who handle the set-off debt program. They get a report every week of every judgment that's been docketed around the state. And if they see it's been docketed without a Social Security number, they have various methods they can use to try to find that Social Security number and then work with the clerk's offices to correct the judgment so it's valid, because if it's docketed without the tax ID number, nothing will happen. Again, we've talked about other ways that we could try to get a better handle on why the recruitment rate varies or whether there's more opportunities for improvement. It's either very time-consuming things, reviewing individual cases, or it would be, you know, we've talked about getting some data from the FMS system, but we know it would be voluminous, and we'd have to match it with the criminal system data, and so not clear that that might help us confirm some of our assumptions about what kind of cases we recoup and what we don't, but we're not sure that that would necessarily pay off. That was all I wanted. Those were the general things I wanted to explain. You also got, I believe, a list of all our counties and how much was recouped last year by attorney's fees, appointment fees, and what percentage that was of the spending in the county that year. That shows that variation in recruitment rates.
Thank you, Ms. Roper. Senator Newton, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, ma'am, for your presentation. I wanted to follow up with you on one of your last slides, on what you were talking about, the Mecklenburg PCA part-time. I believe you're on slide 19.
Mm-hmm.
Your slide indicates, if I'm reading it correctly, that this position or these positions are funded by recruitment revenues, but I thought I understood you to say that they helped with recruitment of fees. First of all, clarify that if you would, and then I have some follow-up questions. Okay. Thank you.
And I probably should explain, all these recruitment revenues, with two exceptions, go into our private assigned counsel fund and are turned around to, you know, pay attorney's fees, except we do pay for the set-off debt staff that implement that program and for this one part-time position in Mecklenburg. So we are able to, we had permission years ago to create that position with our recruitment receipts for that position. And so what they do is they make sure the fee applications get from one part of the, they make sure they're complete, they make sure that they have tax ID numbers, and then they make sure that they're going to the proper piece within the courthouse. And so it's not all directly related to recruitment, but it's making sure that that paper flow doesn't get lost in what's a fairly large courthouse.
Follow up?
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it, is, I'll ask a two-part question. One, is it just one position? And if so, how much is the total allocation from the IDS fund towards this position?
I believe it's about, with it's a temporary hourly position, so it's a benefits for women. I believe it's in the $30,000 range. That person works part-time.
All right. Last follow-up. Can you tell us why that position would have been created in the trial court administrator's office as opposed to, say, in the clerk's office?
Not having been part of that initial discussion, I'm not sure. I do know the trial court administrator's office has been concerned about the low level of recruitment in Mecklenburg County, and because the issue of recruitment isn't just the clerk's office, it's also the judge's office and other issues there. So I think it was the idea to have a much more a broader approach at it. It wasn't just because of that one office. They were also willing to, we wanted to create this position. There had been some other issues in Mecklenburg County about attorney's fees, and the trial court administrator was willing to supervise the position. We didn't want to try to supervise them from NURM. So it was just sort of a mutual agreement. A number, I think, probably about 8 or 9 years ago.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative McNeil.
Well, I don't know if this question is as much as a statement. I want to thank you for this. This is an excellent report. I mean, it some of the presentations that y'all have made before, I didn't quite understand what the difference was in some of the recoupment rates, and you did an excellent job in trying to explain that. And I really love your strategies for improvement. My question is that going to end with this report? There's some good strategies here, and who's going to follow up on that? Is it something that we need to do? Is it something that y'all pledge that y'all are going to do? You know, training apparently is part of the issue. When does AOC give this training, or you assist AOC in giving the training? When's the last time any of the training was done? When do you propose to do any training in the future? Excellent report, excellent strategies, but does it end today, or are we really going to do something about trying to fix this? And I understand from your report there's a lot of things that you can't fix. I know there's people out there that's just not going to pay their fees. Either they can't, they get off probation, and somebody, like you said, decides not to continue probation just to get their fees. I understand attorney's fees are the last in the pecking order. But, you know, if it's got to do with clerk's office not following up, and, you know, when the case is over and going over to the civil judgment part, if it's just part of things that the court system can fix, then we need to fix those.
Well, the best, thank you, Representative McNeil, the best vehicle for our training is there's an annual conference of the assistant and deputy clerks. I know we did a presentation last May when that met, and it varies from year to year when it meets. And then we do a lot of, one of the advantages of us going to that training every year is more and more clerk's offices know to call us if they have a question. Because lots of times it just is they get a case in front of them that's not the typical case and they're not sure what to do. And so we get more and more calls from staff in the clerk's office from having had that face time there. So that's part of it. In terms of our ongoing investigation, we've had a pilot project that's gotten stalled just by staff resources and weather and things of that sort. actually, we have a couple clerk's offices that have pulled files for us already to go in and look at. I talked with some ASC staff just this week about getting an extract of data to see if there was anything we could do with it. Got some suggestions of a couple of counties that would be good to look at, where we would go in now and see what kind of, you know, we know what the recruitment rate is now, get some more specific information about which cases had recruitment and which didn't. Maybe look at a county where we're going in with contracts and then see how it changes after contracts. We're interested in developing a system to follow up with our contractors to make sure that those recruitment forms are being submitted. So we have a couple of balls in the air that are on our tentative work plans. So we're not intending to stop thinking about it. We just don't have anything to present to you today as a result of this.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Walker, for your report. You didn't mention anything about it, so I don't know if there are legal issues or administrative issues, but what about the issue of garnishments?
I'm not sure I know the legal restrictions of that, but my understanding is there's very specific restrictions on when garnishment can be used, and that attorney's fees is not one of those cases. I don't know if there's anybody else here of the knows that more definitively, but that's certainly what I've been told.
They'll follow up on that. They said that the list of the counties recruitment is online. It's on our website. Okay, I have never mind. Oh, I know what I was going to ask. Have you talked to our IT department, our IT committee? Have you presented to them? Because they're working really on IT, trying to get as many things involved as possible.
Representative Hurley, no, we have not. I think the IT issues that we are concerned about are just that the volume of the data and matching that volume of data with a totally different system. I wasn't sure that it was an IT system issue, just the
well, just it would be if we're in clerk's office, if they're doing stuff with IT now, if there could be a connection there somehow to bring it to somebody's attention. But thank you for presenting today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last but not least, we have Jeffrey M. Marisick. Hope I did good. And information technology services in the court system. Good one to follow, huh?
Chair Hurley. Members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me to speak to you today about information technology in the courts. My name is Jeff Marisick, and I am the relatively new Chief Information Officer for the Administrative Office of the Courts. I started my new job on New Year's Eve of this past year, and I'm heading now into my third half month on the job. And I'm disappointed to report that Mother Nature didn't give me a very good welcome here with two snowstorms and a couple of tornadic events since I've been here. Certainly the people of North Carolina have given me a warm welcome, and I really do appreciate that. I've been the Chief Information Officer in several different organizations throughout my career. I've been in this business for about 30 some years, and when I start a new job, I like to spend a little time accumulating what I consider to be the information technology services drivers of that new organization. And so my presentation today, I would like to share with you a number of things that I've found along the way, and some ideas that we have to move forward, and what some of our challenges are. So first, I'll talk about the IT service delivery drivers that I found in this organization, in the judicial branch here in North Carolina. Then I'll talk a little bit about connecting people using technology. I tend to think of the information technology book of work, if you will, separated into two classifications of activities. One, I consider the boxes and the wires. It's the infrastructure stuff that allows us to run applications. And the other part is the actual applications that people use. So we'll talk a little bit about connecting people using technology, a little bit about performing work using technology, the applications that we do and that we provide, and then connecting processes using technology because we interact with other governments, other agencies, and other organizations throughout the state. And then I'll spend a little bit of time talking about some of the information technology challenges that we have seen, that I have seen since I've been here, and then talk a little bit about next steps. So laying out in a broad sense what it is we have, what our challenges are, and what we're going to do about it. So the first first aspect of this presentation is just to talk a little bit about the geography and the demographics of North Carolina. Now, nothing on this slide is news to you, but for me, since it's only been I've only been here for about 3.5 months, it is very enlightening to me. North Carolina has 100 counties. You all know that. It's not news. It is the seventh most number of counties of all the states in the United States. Coming from Oregon, which is where I came from, that state had about 36 counties. So there's a dynamic there. There's a lot of different activities going on in each of the counties, and we provide service to each one of those. So about 10 million people in population. Again, if you add that up, you know, if you rank that amongst all 50 states, it's the 10th largest in the United States, which also has some dynamics. If you look at those counties and arrange them by their populations, we have counties that have nearly a million. Mecklenburg has over 960,000, maybe close to a million at this point, all the way down to Terrell, that has just over 4,000 in their population. That presents a very interesting technology driver from our perspective, because we have very large populated counties, which usually results in a lot more resources, and then you have small counties that don't have as many resources. And the information technology that we provide across the state needs to serve both of those types of populations. Of course, the travel time from end to end, east to west, from Murphy to Mania, is about 10 hours. And so we have a very geographically diverse population. And from north to south is about 4 hours. And so when we think about delivering physical commodities across the state, such as computers and those kinds of things, we need to take into account how broad and how wide the state is. And it's about 49,000 or so square miles. Again, none of that is information to anybody here, but I think the takeaway here is that a geographically dispersed organization is really challenged by time, size, and distance, and information technology is one way that we can address those challenges. So let me talk a little bit about connecting people using technology. Throughout the judicial branch of government, we have quite a few different constituencies, different types of user groups, different drivers. There are 533 elected officials in the judicial branch, including Supreme Court justices, judges, attorneys, clerks, and there are 696 appointed officials as well. Again, I'm pretty sure that's not news to anybody in this room, but for me, as a chief information officer, it's important for me to know the types of users that we have. There are over 6,000, almost 6,600 judicial branch employees that our systems service, and over 33,000 law enforcement officers, citizens also service them, as well as those unknown citizens that we learned about a little bit earlier. I thought I'd spend a little bit of time talking about how technology gets delivered, because it's one of those things that doesn't always isn't always well known in folks that really aren't in the information technology business. So I thought I'd lay out here very, very briefly what we call the anatomy of a courthouse, but essentially it could be any location, any physical location that we're in. As a matter of fact, this building would be wired very similarly. On the bottom row of the picture, we have faxes, phones, and PCs. Now, if I were to build our network and our infrastructure back from your desk, that's what you see on your desk. You see the PCs, you see a phone, sometimes you see a fax, and sometimes you see a printer there. And so that's your interface with what our systems are. The second row from the bottom up are some of the things that are common to the building. Usually they're in a file server room or perhaps a small data center, and it allows those computers that are on your desk to connect back to a common area so that you can save your files, your Word documents, email, voicemail, those kinds of things. So we have a server, we have a voicemail repository or another server, a gateway, and something we call UPS. That's an uninterruptible power supply. And that provides power, for those of you that don't know, to this whole system. In case we have a brownout or in case power goes down, it allows the technology to either stay up during the brownout or it gives us time to do what we call a organized shutdown if the power is out for good. In the next tier up, the third row up from the bottom, we have something called a switch. And a switch just allows all the computers that are on your desk right now to communicate with each other. All the wires get connected back to a switch. If there's wireless connectivity, those things get connected back to a switch, and that allows you to access those servers wherever you are and communicate amongst each other. And finally, in the top, we have something that we call a router, and a router is the thing that connects you to the outside world. So once your information leaves this building, you know it's going through a router. Okay, and a router then can go one of two ways. It can go down our data network, or it can go to our voice communication networks. So the first three layers from the bottom up live within this building. The top one gets you outside the building. So how does this work in the judicial branch network? Well, we have over 250 copies of that thing that I just described. And some of those are large, and some of them are small in terms of how many employees are in those buildings. And in fact, we have over 25,000 components across the state that we maintain, manage through this connectivity. There's a partial list there, and there are others. There's some things in there that more esoteric, but those are the most visible ones. So our network contains well over 25,000 components in it, in the field, across the state, 10 hours from it end to end, 4 hours from north to south. Now, all of these locations then get tied back to the judicial center's data center. So in order for us to share applications, everybody on that network, they all go through those routers and through some other switching gear that we want to get into a little more of a nerdy conversation. We can talk about that a little bit later. But in essence, there's a line from your desk through your desktop PC through the router right back to the judicial center mainframe or data center. Now, what do we have there? Well, in the data center there, again, this is a partial list of equipment, but we have two mainframe computers, have 575 data center servers. So the same types of servers that were in the courthouse, we have another 575 back at the data center that manage our large applications and manage our data and serve files to people and back things up and archive things and all those sorts of things like that. We have three storage area networks. Now, storage area network, excuse me, storage area network is, best way to think about it is a very large disk drive. We have three of those that manage the data, and store the data, back up the data, and it amounts to an industry term, 1.4 petabytes of data, which is a lot of data. We try to put statistics on that or numbers on that to show how much data that actually is. And if you think about, first of all, it's 1 quadrillion, which is 1 with 15 zeros after it. And if you think about what a byte is a single character on a page, an A, a B, a C, a 1, 2, or 3. And you can think about 1 quadrillion of those in storage capacity, which is about 500 billion sheets of paper or so. We also in the data center have data replication systems, tape backup systems, more uninterruptible power supplies, some backup generation, high availability and redundancy, and disaster recovery components. This is important for the data center because, as you saw on earlier slides, we have a lot of users and customers in the field, partners, and they rely on this information. If we suffered an outage at the data center, then justice would kind of grind to a halt and people would not be able to do their job. And so we need to build a lot of redundancy into our networks and into our data center and into our courthouses so that we make this information available. So now that we have the architecture laid out and the network kind of laid out, what do? Well, one thing is we provide 24/7/365 availability of that network. And we need to do that, as I said, because justice doesn't go to sleep at night. And how do we do that? We have what we call a network operations center. We have folks that their main job is to keep track of the components on the network, make sure the servers are running, make sure that those routers are up and running, make sure the data center is running, and they are first alert to any problems we might have in the network. And if they do notice a problem, they call some of our other technical staff to come in and help repair it and help fix it. That's one of the ways that we provide 24/7 availability. The other thing that we do, and one of the reasons why I talked on that first slide about the geography of the state, is because it takes a while to drive it. If everybody was located in Raleigh and we had a problem perhaps out in Manio or out in Murphy, it would take a while to get there to fix it. This map here shows how we have some of our staffs kind of strategically located throughout the state physically. And the colors on this map show support areas. So we have teams that get associated with the colors on this map so that if there is a problem that can't be handled remotely through the NOC or through the electronic or remote systems that we have, and we need to deploy somebody there, we can get somebody there within an hour and a half at the worst case, hour and a half to 2 hours, depending upon where they are. It makes our response time less, and it's more cost effective than having several staff at each of our locations. So we do this, staff this team with about 24 people or so, or these teams with about 24 people, and we try to provide coverage across the state by strategically locating them out in the field already. So that's our infrastructure side. Now let's talk a few minutes about our applications. This is a very small subset of the applications that we support and develop at AOC. And I just picked a few examples here. There are over 50 major applications that we have in you've probably heard of some of these. The ACES system is the first one, NC Aware, e-citation, which a lot of police officers use in their cars, pay NC ticket, and we talked a little bit earlier about the credit card payment system that's being rolled out now. Now, I think that the key takeaway from this particular slide is the number of times the word million appears on the screen in terms of the number of transactions that flow through the system and how much activity is there. So that kind of gives you an idea of the usage of these systems and why we need so much disk space, for example, and why we need a lot of processing power, because a lot of folks depend on these systems and there are millions of transactions that flow through. As a matter of fact, in ACES, the third bullet point down under there, we process about 1 million transactions a day through that particular system. So there are plenty of there's a lot of activity here, and a lot of people depend on these systems. The next part is how do we interact with other agencies? So we talked a little bit about the hardware and the networks and how that works, the data center and other applications. Now this is our I know it's a little bit hard to read, but this is a slide. The next two slides here will show a very similar picture in how we communicate with other systems that are not AOC systems, some of them are, and other agencies in different jurisdictions. We have 12 real-time interfaces from our criminal court systems, and a real-time interface means that as soon as somebody types something into the screen and presses enter, it updates the local system, but then it also automatically updates another system, or when another system is calling for information, it will happen immediately. You won't have to wait for an overnight process. We have 17 batch interfaces as well on our criminal systems, which means overnight we run jobs that update systems, extract data, ship data somewhere else, save it for other uses in other agencies. The 14 different government agencies that we share data with at all levels, local level, other state agencies, as well as federal level. And we also share data with vendors and other private entities. So a very similar slide here in our non-criminal court system as well. The story is very similar. The picture is the same, and I think you get the idea on that. So what are our challenges? Again, I spent my last 3.5 months pulling all of this together, collecting all the information, and when I sit back and I think about, well, what is it that really challenges our systems today? Here are the things that I come up with. Of those 50 or so judicial branch applications, over 40 of them or so are more than 5 to 10 years old. We have 11 of them that are more than 16 years old. 9 of them that are more than 20 years old. Old technology is costly and increasingly hard to maintain. Some of the oldest systems here, and ACES is one of them, one of the systems we talked about earlier, that's a workhorse for the judicial branch, that particular system. It is, however, built on old technology. You probably heard the term green screen or some other description of that. And that's one of those systems that we are in the process of replacing, but we're replacing it very slowly because of other higher priority activities. So we apply resources to that when we have them, and as variable resources come and go, we work on additional modules. We have a pretty big workload at AOC. Right now we have 19 major projects that are currently underway. So all of our staff are engaged in that. And there are two different ways that I look at our projects. We have application development projects, and we have infrastructure projects as well. So I mentioned that we were replacing ACES in a modular way. The first one in the application development projects is an indication that we're ready to release section 5.5 of our replacement project, and we're ready to begin to roll that out in June of this year. Now, here's an interesting thing that I wanted to emphasize on that. It's one thing to create the module, and we've been working on that module for about 6 or 8 months, maybe even a little longer than that, 10 months, and it's ready to go. We're in final testing of that particular module. We'll have it ready to go probably in June of 2014, but then we need to roll it out across the state. And so that's why that first slide becomes important, because we have 100 different counties to roll it out into. Training is involved. We need to be able to make sure that our staff is able to use the new application module when it's available and rolled out. Many of them use this particular tool in the courtroom. And so the last thing we need is to roll out a new application with some people not being able to use it and have an interruption in our court process. And so typically, when we have large rollouts like this, it could take 12 months to 18 months to roll that out. Just based on the geography and the distance and the number of users that we have, the number of courthouses that we have, and all those things that we talked about earlier. So that's why the technology drivers is an important thing to understand. Certainly for me, it's important to understand, because I need to figure out how to do that better, figure out how to do that faster. There's one thing I learned in 30 years of doing this, is that time has a way of killing good technology ideas. If it takes 12 or 18 months to roll out a new piece of technology, by the time it's rolled out, it's probably not new technology anymore. So we're working on doing that faster. And so for that particular application, we have adjusted some of what we're doing. We've rearranged some priorities. And our objective is to roll that out across the state by the end of this calendar year. So it'll be available in June, and hopefully within 6 months, we'll have that rolled out. Now that's a new thing for us, that's a new way to do it. And some other things suffer. Some of these other 19 projects that we have on the list will slow down, but it's more important, we think, to get a completed module out in the field and used, because the functionality that we have rolling out will improve the efficiency of those that are using. We have other systems that are rolling out on the infrastructure side. The next bullet point down is 2,000 requests for application enhancements. These are smaller requests. Perhaps there's an error in the system, or an error message that pops up, or something like that. Something that we wouldn't consider a project, but nevertheless, somebody has requested. We have about 2,000 of those that we go through a process, a methodical process of prioritizing them, assigning resources to them, putting them into releases, and getting them into the field. Beyond that, we have, and this list grows almost every day, we have 80 major project requests coming from all of our different stakeholders across the state. And again, I break them down into two categories: application development, as well as infrastructure projects, and we log them. So we have 80 different things for the staff to work on, and our job is to figure out which of those 80 are the most important ones to work on. Now, historically, the Technology Services Division at AOC has spent a lot of time on their customer service skills. And there's a concept that I learned a couple of years ago, that we could be customer service oriented almost to a fault. And what I mean by that here is that if we don't focus on a few things and get them built, get them done, get them deployed into the field, everything takes longer to do. If we try to take on too much work at one time, and we try to satisfy everybody's needs by working on too many different things, everything takes longer to get done. And so one of the things that we're going to be doing is focusing in on figuring out a good way to pick the most important things to work on and apply our resources to fix those things get those done, and then get to the next level. So that's another challenge, a lot of things to do. The next item that I consider one of the challenges, and again, this is why those first several slides were important, is what I call maintaining the installed base. So I mentioned that we had over 25,000, probably close to 30,000 components in the field that we need to manage and people use. Not only do they use them, but they're dependent on them. They need to know, and we need to provide a service that says when they come to work tomorrow morning, those applications and those systems that they're working with this afternoon work the same way, meaning that we need to pay attention to life cycle replacement of all of that gear, right? When things get old, they break down. There are moving parts, disk drives break. I'm sure a lot of you maybe experience some of that. Software gets out of date. All the software vendors, the operating system vendors, Microsoft and those folks are always changing their software, so we have to make sure that each of those things is up to date. Information security has become a huge workload for a lot of organizations. Almost every organization that has large operations like this, every day there are new information security exploits out there. So we have a number of our staff that are dedicated to making sure that the installed base is there and ready to go, and a lot of our resources, in fact, go to maintaining that installed base. This chart is an annualized depiction of the components of the installed base. And I provide that as illustration. It's probably a 5-year or so annualized depiction of our resource allocation to just maintaining the installed base. The top part of it is hardware and services broken down into several categories. And the bottom part is personnel. I want to draw your attention to kind of the parentheticals on the left-hand column under the personnel side. 93% of our infrastructure staff is dedicated to making sure that the networks stay functional, performant, and operational, and secure. And over 75% of our internal application staff are dedicated to that same endeavor. So it's important. Our number one priority in this regard is to make sure every morning and every day people can work and they remain working. In total, that's probably over 85 or 90% of our total information services resources applied to that. Now, if you look at that a different way, that leaves only about 10 or 15% that are available for doing new things. So if we look back at this slide and we're talking about that 80 major project requests that have been logged, we have about 10% of our staff, or 15, that can be deployed to work on that problem. That's a big constraint for us. It's a big challenge for us when we want to get rid of our 20-year-old applications like ACES. And that's why we took a modular approach to that, because we're never sure from one year to the next where the resources are for that. And so we have to bite it off in small chunks. And of course, biting it off in small chunks elongates the completion of that project. Another challenge that we have, and this is something that isn't unique to us, I don't believe. I think it's something that all public entities are dealing with. Certainly where I came from in Oregon, I worked with the Oregon State Pension System there. We had the same issue where a lot of our staff were losing a lot of our most seasoned and experienced staff to local private companies because we couldn't pay them what they could get in the private sector. And so within the last year and a half, we lost 6 from our infrastructure team, and we lost 3 others from our application development team, and as a matter of fact, before I came here today, we found out that we just lost another one from our infrastructure team as well. And a lot of these folks are leaving our employment for salaries that are $8,000 to $30,000 more for similar jobs in other organizations. So that's a big problem for us as we move forward here. How do we retain and find the talent? Now we're also experiencing that last bullet point there. We're also experiencing an increasing number of rejected offers to fill those positions that people left for. We have at least, just recently, within the last month or 6 weeks, we offered two or three different people a salary to fill one of the ones that left earlier, and it was rejected every time. So we're back to our third or fourth recruitment effort to fill one position. And again, they're rejecting the offers because they could find they could do the same job elsewhere. All right, so what do we do about all this? So that's the story. Now I've been around a little while, as I mentioned before, about 30 years, and these problems aren't uncommon to any large organization. It is a matter of trying to set the appropriate priorities and putting in the right processes and procedures with which to deal with them, so that we're working on the most important things at any given time. And so the three-step approach that we're working on at AOC is to first establish our governance process, and that's a project that's well underway. And the governance process, the IT governance process, the goal of the process is to first establish input into our information technology needs and requirements. And frankly, I've heard a number of those today as I was sitting in this meeting. So there are a lot of stakeholders and partners that are in the room. And as I come to meetings like this, I hear of other opportunities to identify which technology solutions we should be pursuing. And so we need to create that list of 80 that I pointed out a little bit earlier. That list will probably grow to 100, 150, or even more at the beginning of our governance process. We want to hear from our constituents what business problems they're having, rather than what technology solutions they want. We want to hear what is slowing them down, what is not working right, what is getting in the way of them being efficient, and we're going to categorize those and work through a process that allows us to work like a funnel, take all the good ideas, vet them, figure out how the processes work together, look at it from an end-to-end process perspective, categorize them, prioritize them, have buy-off on them from our various governance constituency groups or affinity groups that we'll be working with, and then apply the appropriate resources to them. Right? So we'll be very clear about what it is we're working on, when, why, focus on them, and get those projects completed. All that work will feed into our strategic planning process. So this time next year, as we're preparing our budget, we'll have a strategic planning document that will say, that will outline very clearly where it is we're going, why we're going there, and what we'll be working on, and what the resources will be to achieve those goals. We can't do everything for everybody right away, but I think we could do a lot better job of trying to show where we're going, give the rationale for why we're going there, and communicate heavily on where we are in that process. And finally, that last box, process efficiency and technology simplification, that's the goal that we're all shooting for. We want to find out how better to integrate the systems that we do have, replace the ones that aren't working appropriately or efficiently, and get rid of old technology or duplicative technology. one of the cost drivers that we have, I mentioned the two systems, ACES, which is our 20-year-old legacy system, and its replacement, the CCIS system. They do the same function, or their goal is to do the same function with new functionality being built into the CCIS version of it. But in essence, CCIS will replace ACES. Today, we're about 70% converted. So 70% of ACES functionality is working in the new system, 30% of it is still working in the old system, but our costs for maintaining the old system don't really go away. We still have the cost of the hardware it runs on. We still have the cost of the database licenses that it runs on. We still have the cost of programmers to make sure it stays running. Until we get rid of that, we won't be able to recognize those costs, cost savings. That's where we're heading. And when I talk about technology simplification, those are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. Reduce the amount of complexity in our environment, reduce the number of things that are different in our environment, consolidate on proven technologies and architectures, and move forward. And so that's kind of a whirlwind tour of my 3.5 months. So I'll turn it over for questions.
Thank you, Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going to your last few pages there where we're talking about competition for talent, problems in maintaining employees and what have you. And of course, we hear that from many places, and it's also a problem in industry and business as well. Given your many years of background in this field, is there a place for within government entities such as this for independent contractors rather than employees? Do you have any experience in that?
I have plenty of experience in that. There are certainly areas where contractors, independent contractors, can make a great impact to organizations like ours, and in any organization. And the way I look at that is that the further away from needing to know the business a position is, the more impact particular contractors would have. For example, a programmer that needs to work on the ACES system needs to have a lot of institutional knowledge in order to make sure that the programming that they're doing works properly, and they need to understand about the process flows and how information gets exchanged and those sorts of things. So that takes a long time to build. So typically those kinds of positions require some years of experience and some tutelage and those kinds of things that aren't as appropriate to contractors as some other things. Now, we could pair some contractors with some of the more experienced folks and guide them along the way, so there is some opportunity there. On the other end of the spectrum, some things don't require as much institutional knowledge. For example, if we had a large network upgrade project where we go to the courthouses, for example, and replace the routers that we talked about earlier, we could contract out some of that. It would be supplemental to our existing staff for the same reason, to keep the continuity. But but that would be a variable type of resource. The project would come, would hit it hard, use contractors to get things into the field. Project would complete, contractors would go away. So there is a spot for them in the organization.
Somewhat.
In doing your further planning and evaluating for this, would you be willing to take a look at the possibility? The reason I ask is it's not only salary. There are a lot of, as you well know, there are a lot of other costs involved for an employer, and pensions and all those things. And consequently, if there is a slot that an independent contractor could fill for, let's say, pay that independent contractor a competitive amount because you would not be spending the other benefits. So
sure.
If you're willing to take a look at that, I think it might be might help us in more than just your reason.
Right. Representative Faircloth, we do in fact employ contractors in this work in that way, even for less than a 3-year time frame, but we also do employ them and use them as strategically as we can. But I'm perfectly willing to look at that.
Representative McNeil.
Thank you. I've got a couple of questions, if you'll bear with me. I noticed you on the slide 20, I think it is, said the network communication services was about $4.5 million a year. Mm-hmm. How much of that is fiber, if you know?
Yeah. Boy. I don't know. I can get back to that. I have other people that know that in more detail.
Okay. Where I'm going with that is I know one of the major problems that we've talked about in this committee is video testimony.
Yep.
It's needed a lot for the crime lab as far as their traveling and everything like that. Tell me if you know, and then leave out the equipment that you need at the courthouse. Do you think this network communication services that we've got now, this pipeline or whatever you want to call it, bandwidth, is sufficient to do video testimony without being added to at this point?
So you're talking about network network services? Yeah, we're in close communication with SBI and DOJ on this particular pilot project. We don't think that our network would need to be upgraded at all. As a matter of fact, we'll be ready to do a pilot of that particular project within the next week or so. But our analysis really has to do with how many projected simultaneous calls would happen using that technology, and the way we have discussed it with DOJ and SBI and the technical staff, both our staff and theirs, we think that our network will handle it very well. Now, on the same topic, that's not the only video project we have going. Yeah. And so we already, excuse me, we already do video video calls with magistrates, for example. I think in about 40, maybe 50 or 60 different counties, we're already using the same infrastructure for some magistrate appearances and those sorts of things. We have... We're looking at similar technology to use in our business courts, video technology. We have another request to look at video technology for remote competency hearings. So this is technology that's coming down the road. So we think that over the next year or so, once the technology is established, we'll see a lot more usership. Which then gets you to the thing you asked me not to think about, and that is the technology in the courtrooms. The more we use it, the more presence we have, the more components we have to have in our many courtrooms. We have well over 1,000 courtrooms, 1,500 courtrooms or so. And for example, for the expert witness remote testimony project, we talked with the folks in Forsyth County, and we took a look at the various rooms where this technology, where this testimony might happen, and we figured that it would happen in 3 different courtrooms there, and there may be a possibility that would happen in 2 of them simultaneously. So the thought was we would create a mobile unit that can be rolled from courtroom to courtroom, but then the need might in that particular courthouse be at least 2 of these units, if not 3. And so we take that and we multiply that through all the counties, all those demographics that we talked about earlier, and that's where the cost comes from.
Okay, and you read my mind. I had noticed on slide 19 where you had magistrate video rollout. So that was going to be one of my questions. But do you have it off the top of your head, and you may not know, about how many counties in North Carolina already have video systems in their courtrooms?
Zero, other than some of our business courts that I'm aware of. There are systems. I don't know if the counties put some of their own equipment. I don't know, have that level of detail, but as far as we're concerned.
And one last question. For those counties that do have local systems, local video systems, how hard would it be to use the infrastructure they already have and just kind of piggyback off that?
We are, interesting that you bring that up, we are having a conversation with Mecklenburg yesterday, today, or in a couple of days from now on that very topic. They have some equipment, and we want to talk about how it could be used on our infrastructure, if possible, and how we might be able to use such systems, but we haven't yet had that conversation yet. But
yeah, I think the approach to that, as well as the approach to those interface slides that I showed a little bit earlier, is to establish some standards and guidelines for technology so that when two different jurisdictions implement the same standard, it's much easier to communicate across the jurisdictions. And that's the approach that we're using. And of course, you can see from those slides that it's a very successful type of approach, and we've been doing that for a number of years. It would be similar here, to adopt the standards that we can use across the state, across the jurisdictions, so that we can take advantage of it. And that's an emerging field in some ways, and it's certainly best practices in others. The IT industry has been developing these types of standards for years. It's a matter of getting everybody to agree to them.
Representative Turner. Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that the CCIS system was at about 70%, and you're still having to maintain ACIS. Do you have a timetable on that, when it might be ready to turn over to completely operate on CCIS?
No, we don't have a timetable. What we do is we have groups of functionality that we have grouped together, and we have kind of projected out packages, called deployment packages. What we don't have, though, is a consistent resource to do it. And so we work on it when we can. And sometimes our teams have enough resources, and we start on them, and then something else pops up, a critical issue pops up, so we have to move some people from there to there. And so it's very difficult to establish a timeline if we can't say for the next X number of years, you have the funding, you have the resources, the staff are dedicated to it. Now that's what we'd like to get, but today we don't. But we do have a strategy for getting there. It's just how long it will take. We don't have the answer.
Follow up. So it would be personnel and finances?
Predominantly personnel.
Thank
predominantly
you.
Personnel on that project.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Marisik. I don't believe there's any more questions for you.
Okay, well thank you very much for allowing me to speak today.
Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
Does the committee have any other burning situations they want to discuss? Okay, meeting adjourned.